It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go. Happy Independence Day to you. Happy midweek Independence Day. It is, in fact, Wednesday, the 4th day of July, 2018. Independence Day here in the United States of America when we... Well, you know what? We'll talk about what we're celebrating here in a little bit because I've got a real treat for us all. I talked to Dr. Bill earlier today, and he's gonna pop by here in a few minutes, and we'll talk some Declaration of Independence esoterica. And see what Dr. Bill, who has forgotten more American history than most of us will ever know, has to add to the quantum of knowledge on this Independence Day. It is also, of course, by consensus, it's a 4th of July on the front porch, or Independence Day on the front porch. We gave the little old blue-haired ladies in the Fellowship Hall cafeteria the night off and just decided to kick back and put her feet up on the porch rail and cuss and discuss on this Independence Day holiday. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's 2 minutes past the hour, and we have thanks to send out, as we do every evening when we have subscribers. We have thanks to send out to Catherine in California. Thank you very kindly, Catherine, and thanks also to our buddy Paul. Thank you, Paul. Thank you very kindly for jumping in to the fray and helping, and thank you both of you for being partial sponsors of the program month in and month out. It's really, really helpful to know that our subscribers are there, and it, when everything works out as it should, we wind up with a week of fundraising free radio at the end of every month. Also, we have a new subscriber to celebrate. Thank you very kindly to Thomas. Thank you very much indeed for becoming one of the happy not quite 100 who makes up for about a fourth of the Horn's monthly funding needs. Thank you very kindly, Thomas. It is much appreciated. Of course, everybody who chips in gets a mention and thank you, either live on air during the program, or if you're a subscriber on the day that your subscription rolls in. Yay! Because that really, I mean, that's the only reason this program exists. And so we raised not a nickel last night. We had 180 bucks. Well, we did raise. Yes, thank you very kindly to Frank. We raised 20 bucks. That left 180, so we've got 200 this evening. And as a result, that works out to being 380 bucks we need to raise this evening to stay even this early in the month of July. The summer is running past us, it seems. And, of course, similar to what I mentioned on Monday, I have to issue a caveat in regard to this broadcast. There are and have been thunderstorms running through. The power has blinked repeatedly here at the fabulous Kincaid Mansion and the awe-inspiring Horn Studios. And we got about a 30% chance of more typical, ordinary, predictable summer thunder showers passing through, which of course caused the marvelous, craptastic, ancient, rickety, coal-fired power grid from back in the 19th century, as maintained or not maintained or poorly maintained by the fine folks at Appalachian Power, to run. Well, the whole grid runs under the bed and shivers and hides. So there's that. And so if the program, well, it's kind of like Monday. I mean, it was living proof. You may hear some of the thunder coming over the microphone. But if the program just suddenly disappears, it will be because the stunningly awful, rickety, antiquated coal-fired power grid of Appalachian Power has once again fallen apart. So that's where that stands. Oh, and thank you to Kelly for signing on for a new subscription this month. Thank you very kindly. That's wonderful. Thank you, Kelly. So that actually means we'll count that. And Thomas is in this evening, so that makes it 360 to go to stay even with the month of July, 4 days into the month. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you very, very much. Okay. So we're gonna have like I said, I'm gonna be chatting with Dr. Bill O'Brien here in a few moments, but because it was so very well received, I mean, I had a lot of people who responded and said they just enjoyed the daylights out of it. I think it's a good idea to check in with more letters from the Second Civil War. You may recall that none other than Alex Jones predicted that the liberals and progressives would start a second civil war on the 4th of July. He has been mocked relentlessly since, and I hate to miss out on a good mocking. So with that in mind, yes, more letters from the Second Civil War.
Dear beloved, as a nurse tending the wounded at the Battle of Covfefe, I witnessed the daily struggle with facts, supporting evidence, and basic grammatical structure. It's war. It's ugly.
My dear mother, Dems have once again surrounded us from a firm position on the moral high ground. We can no longer eat Tex-Mex in peace. Have sent to Russia for help, the scoundrel Mueller pursues. There is talk of a blue wave. I fear we shall not endure.
My dearest, as a member of the Union's military, I shall damn the Second Amendment to my dying breath. Our artillery of tanks, drones, and nuclear bombs is surely no match for this well-regulated militia of hillbillies with guns from Walmart. Alas.
More to come.
My dearest cousin Marveline, my angle. Morrill is low in the 69th West Virginia Maggots Brigade. Colonel the Nuge got himself electrocuted a waving his gun in the air and hooting about cold dead fingers. Lightning got him hot right quick. Love to our sweet chlamydia Jean, cousin Cletus. Maul. Conditions are real bad.
we are forced to bunker down in a swampy rented townhome with used mattresses. Sergeant Pruitt keeps ordering us out to steal more rations, lotion, from the Ritz-Carlton. I reckon he thinks of himself as a four-star attorney general.
Dear Covfefe, my battalion is currently eating potato skins and listening to the rain move through. I can hear faint cussing over the thunder from the tiki torch and walk-away crowd as their torches and paths are doused and flooded. Tis a good day. Mother, the tide has turned. Hope was fading until we built a wall in front of the advancing Red Hats. They appear utterly confounded and unaware of the use of ladders, tunnels, or aircraft to penetrate this border. Spirits broken, they flee. My dearest cousin Marveline, things look bad for the 69th WV Maggots Brigade. General Bonespurs ain't been seed since he retreated from the Greenbrier last night. We heard he was a-feeling poorly. All my love to our precious Chlamydia Jean. Your cousin, Cletus. Dearest daughter, this early afternoon we captured a group of Red Hats wandering across the Detroit-Windsor border. We kept apologizing while drinking Labatt's, as Canadians do, to distract them while knotting their shoelaces together. Dear Jane, the Red Hats are sitting around arguing over whether Ivanka can become president when her father dies. Half say she can't because she's a woman. The other half are insistent that Trump will live forever. P.S. The rainbow quinoa salad was a real hit. Received breaking news from the front, received reports that the D.C. airport has been taken, but it appears FLOTUS is not going down without a fight. She's armed, dangerous, and impossible to understand. Proceed with caution. Dearest, I contacted General Kushner and introduced myself as very important business person Bozo McUnumskull. He bowed and personally escorted me to the Oval Office. I went in and told the president that Barack Obama could fly. The war is over. Commander Waters' plan for a 4th of July campaign was a stroke of genius. With so much of the enemy's leadership away at a strategy retreat with General Putin, their army will be quite vulnerable. Victory is near. Your loving son. Dearest, our foe confounds us. Though they claim to love both the Constitution and the Bible, they seem to have not read either. And don't get me started on how they treat people actually named Jesus. Day one. Battle has not yet reached me, but I continue to fish for my platoon, as I'm useless in combat. No gun. Numerous turtles swam by, gathering intel, I'm assuming. Gave them the finger and yelled, "Fuck you, Mitch," to each one. And finally, cousin Marveline, they read us the Constitution today. Us 69th WV maggots cheered when Major Steve Bannon got to the part about black folks being three-fifths of a person. Now they're telling us to form up to march. Kiss our Chlamydia Jean for me. Your cousin, Cletus. True letters from the Second Civil War. It's 14 minutes past the hour, and we can put away the syrupy fiddle now. It is Independence Day. Let's see. Quick math.
It's 200. It's 40. Yeah. It's 6. Yeah. 242. It's the 242nd anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Not the signing, and not necessarily the publication, but of its generally received knowledge within the colonies at the time. Like I said earlier in the day, just a little bit ago, because he had spent a considerable amount of time on the Declaration of Independence in his own program earlier today, I got in touch with Dr. Bill O'Brien and wanted to add some historical perspective to the Declaration and Independence Day that maybe some other folks hadn't touched upon. So without further ado, let me go over to the phone line and say good evening, Dr. Bill. How are you?
Bob, I'm great. How are you?
Just dandy. It struck me that, I've been thinking about it for a couple of days, but this being the actual 4th, it seemed appropriate we should have this conversation on this day.
Oh, okay. Geez, I tuned in and listened. I hope the hell the Second Civil War doesn't get rained out tonight, Bob.
It's been a little mushy there for a few days now, as far as I can tell.
If it depends on Appalachian power, it may not happen.
Well, I think Appalachian power went AWOL in the second Civil War long about Monday, as far as I could tell.
Yeah.
Oh, what a bunch of amateurs!
Their rates continue to go up, though, don't they?
Well, you know, you have it's like that. You know your Marx Brothers movies, right? I'm a big Marx Brothers fan. There's that exchange between Groucho and Chico, where Groucho has hired Chico's band to play at some event, and he says, what do you get? How much do you want? And he says $200, and he says that's a lot of money. He says, we got to rehearse. He says, what do you get if you don't rehearse? Hell, you can't afford that. That's Appalachian power in a nutshell. I mean, it costs a lot of money to have them be this incompetent.
Yeah.
But
it's unbelievable. It is.
And I mean, it's not just me. Ask anybody. I don't think there's anybody out there who go, oh, yeah, that Appalachian power, they sure are one Jim Dandy power company.
Yeah. The number of power interruptions is incredible. I still can't. I've been here for a long time, but I still can't get used to it. It's amazing.
More so than other parts of the country. I guess maybe that's because we're so mountainous, or maybe it's because we rely on coal.
Well, I remember the old Lone Ranger black and white series on television, when they would be stringing wire for Morse code, and they would climb up the ladder and use the butt of the pistol to nail the wire to the pole. And I, honest to God, that's what it looks like here half the time.
And the horse had AEP branded on its flank, right?
Yeah.
So, it was several years ago when I first heard you talking about the real background to the Declaration of Independence, and it has stayed with me ever since. But the other night, Monday night, before the program, disappeared thanks to Appalachian Power, I was actually deconstructing a right-wing Republican spokeswoman. Her name's Kayleigh McEnany, who became incensed, Bill, incensed, that anyone would say that the Constitution was written by white property owners for white property owners. And she said, you can't say that. That's disrespectful to the Constitution. Well, it's kind of a fact, too. You know, I mean, it's inexcusable. It's unavoidable. It's not like Abigail Adams was sitting there in the convention. Now, was she?
No.
Not by, and by the same token, there weren't any women really particular, and certainly no people of color, and damned well no, let's see, what does the document refer to them as? Merciless Indian savages. Mm-hmm. There were no merciless Indian savages there in Philadelphia in 1776, were there?
No, there weren't no representation at all.
And that's kind of odd for a bunch of people who were running around saying no taxation without representation. Without trying to be, you know, just take all the fun out of the 4th of July, there's a little bit of hypocrisy baked into the Declaration, isn't there?
And what exactly do you mean, Bob?
Well, talking about all men are created equal.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
The absence of any mention of women.
Right.
But what's in, you know, there's no mention of those, and there's really no mention, and this is kind of interesting because the right wing is so, people like that wall builder, what's his name? I can't remember, I forget him, who creates fake American history.
David Barton.
Yeah, you know, there's also no Jesus in the Declaration of Independence, but they don't have any problem putting him in there, do they?
No. No, they don't. He becomes very prominent, and in fact Jefferson went to. I mean, if you remember the Jefferson's version of the Bible, where he went through it with a fine tooth comb and extracted all the miracles and all the things that he felt he absolutely couldn't believe, and took them out, and. So I don't think he would have put Jesus back into the Declaration. But it doesn't mean that he didn't believe in God. I mean, he believed in a creator. He was an Enlightenment deist type of thinker who believed that a creator created the universe. But that
creator, just to touch on that real quickly. We would kind of think of they call themselves deists. The closest thing we've got to them these days would be maybe a Unitarian Universalist or perhaps an agnostic, right, or what we call free thinkers.
Right.
I don't think you can make the argument that they were straight up atheists.
No. No, they weren't. And in fact, you know, most of this period, this was really the religion of the educated. Because they were Enlightenment thinkers, and when Jefferson talked about self-evident truths, I've always believed that's very important, because he later in life, many years later, in fact, in the 1820s, not too long before he died, Jefferson kind of explained to Richard Henry Lee in a letter, what he intended with the Declaration. And he says blatantly, I didn't intend to say anything that educated thinking people didn't already believe. My goal was to say what people believe to be true. And of course, that is very consistent with the fact that that particular paragraph of the Declaration, the one that gets all the attention about unalienable rights and endowed by the Creator with them and all of this, got almost no attention by the Congress that ratified the Declaration, that approved the Declaration. Almost all the attention of the members of Congress the Continental Congress that approved it focused on the list of charges and allegations against the king. And that's where they put their emphasis. That to them was the key part of the Declaration. And the paragraph that we spend most of our time focusing on barely got a mention in the debates over the Declaration. And I've always thought that that's very, very relevant, because it reinforces Jefferson's argument that later on that his intent was to base this on what he felt were self-evident truths that educated people throughout the world would buy into, because this was a propaganda document for the world. In other words, explaining to the rest of the world what the colonies intended to do and why they believed they had a right and they had to do it and had a right to do it. And You know, and I've always believed that Jefferson is very consistent, because I heard people say, well, he's very old by the time he writes this letter to Lee, and he's looking to save his legacy and protect his reputation and all of that. The fact of the matter is, he said that these truths were self-evident, and I really believe that he meant that.
And so, there's an argument that when you look at the people who wrote it, you know, he and Franklin and Adams,
right? Sure.
And you look at the group that ratified it, all of whom had what we would consider to be liberal arts education.
Right.
And in particular, devotees of that new fashion and fad from Europe, the Enlightenment, then it probably wasn't something that, I mean, when we say self-evident, Bill, we mean that when they were sitting around over, you know, a few gallons of wine, they did drink quite a bit, and, you know, playing snooker or pinochle or whatever, or whist, they weren't talking about this, because it's like the common understanding that a language is. People who speak a common language don't discuss so much the nature of the language, do they?
The nature of the language. No, exactly. That's a good analogy, because that's exactly right, and that's what Jefferson says that he intended, and you know that these were what people believed. And I've always thought a relevant part of the Declaration, of that particular portion of the Declaration, for example, is Jefferson's use of the term "among these" when he's talking about inalienable rights, and he said "among these are." And so the implication there is that what the ones he mentioned, life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, pursuit of happiness. When he says these are among the inalienable rights, the implication is there are more. And, of course, that's what the property have been trying to do ever since, is include property. As you know, protection of property is one of these inalienable rights.
And that, of course, is a separate topic. I want to get to a couple of things. I wanted to address the issue of property. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of property is a different thing altogether from life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right.
You've talked in the past, and I want to reinforce it this evening in case there are people who haven't heard it, what the difference is between the meaning in 1776. I'm not talking about the meaning in 2018, but what was the difference in meaning in 1776 between life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and life, liberty, and the pursuit of property?
Mm-hmm.
And does happiness equal property? And what, in fact, does happiness mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be beneficial to go into.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, where the rest of the Declaration is concerned, like you said, they just kind of blew past the "when in the course of human events" and we find that to be beautiful, stunning language now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's the part that school kids memorize, or at least used to when school kids memorize things.
Right.
Then they don't memorize the merciless Indian savages part.
No, they don't.
And they don't, because the rest of it is a bill of particulars, basically, against the King of England.
Right.
So, how? And maybe after we talk about the pursuit of part, let's talk a little bit about how the Declaration of Independence was more or less forgotten and brought back to resurrected and transformed into, it's almost got a hagiography of its own.
Mm-hmm.
But let's start with the "among those" part. If lawyers write that way too, when lawyers sit down and they start making lists of things, a lawyer cannot resist his heirs, assigns, successors, and other such forever. You got to cover all the bases. Or if a lawyer is listing an inventory of the kitchenware, The lawyer will say such items as, but not limited to, knives, forks, spoons. You see what I'm saying? They always throw in that, but not limited to.
Right.
And I always thought that that was sort of where they were getting at with the among these, but not limited. So what would some of the, do we know what some of those others would have been? What were they talking about?
I think I've always believed that Jefferson recognized that as times changed, things would come up, you know, one of the, you know, things would come up, you know, challenges would confront society that would necessitate the addition, if you will, of others, of other so-called natural rights. Today, the big debate is about privacy. I mean, because there's so much in our society that seems to infringe on what's left of individual privacy. And there's, you know, the Constitution does not identify privacy as for protection under the Bill of Rights. But the implication would be among, and I've heard people say this, that this would be one of Jefferson's implications. I mean, this would fall under Jefferson's idea of among these unalienable rights are. And the closest thing to it is the Ninth Amendment, which to the Bill of Rights, the Ninth Amendment to the Constitution, which basically said that the mention of these rights doesn't preclude the fact that they might be, that Congress might, in its wisdom, come up with others. And that's the closest thing that people have been able to find in the Constitution that directly pertains to what they would like to believe is individual privacy. But in the Declaration, and of course, one of the things that I've been interested in for a long time is that conservatives for quite some time have insisted that, and in order to do this, they've had to manipulate the Declaration. They've had to change or establish an official meaning of the Declaration. And the meaning that I've heard in the past is that when Jefferson used the term in the Declaration, pursuit of happiness, he meant property. But he couldn't say property because if that was included in it, then too many people would interpret the whole document as being would interpret the movement for independence as being a protection of property for the wealthiest Americans. And to avoid that, the conservative argument goes that Jefferson had to put in something that was politically neutral, and he chose the word happiness. But that's always bothered me.
But happiness was not a politically neutral term. Happiness carried that capital H happiness carried its own freight back then, and had for 100 years or more, had it not?
Yeah, right. And John Locke talked about it. And what one of the most amazing things to me is that less than a month before the Declaration in June, the Virginia legislature adopted the Virginia, a Declaration of Rights. And much of what's in the Declaration of Independence is in the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And Jefferson was involved in the writing of that Virginia Declaration of Rights. And in it, what the Declaration says is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the Virginia Declaration of Rights, the wording is life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. And so in the Virginia Declaration, which was approved less than a month before the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson was involved in distinguishing between happiness and property as two separate things. And that, to me, refutes the traditional argument that Jefferson really meant property when he wrote Pursuit of Happiness, but for political reasons he couldn't say it. So he had to say something like Pursuit of Happiness because everybody could relate to that. And of course, what conservatives have taken from that is that the pursuit of property in their mind, constitutes the pursuit of opportunity. And that, in turn, directly supports the idea of free enterprise capitalism, the individual pursuit of success, private wealth, a career, whatever, you know, whatever you want to use as a replacement for the word happiness. But the key is that this particular spin on the word happiness implies that all the things that might constitute personal happiness or individual happiness are things that come to you. In other words, it's about your wealth, your success, your career, your ability to move up, whatever it is. They're all things that belong to you. When in fact, in the 17th and 18th century, the idea of happiness was your ability to support other people's needs. The idea was, and it's based on the golden rule that, you know, it's better to give than to receive. And the Enlightenment philosophers in Scotland, the Scottish Enlightenment, most of the writers there, including Adam Smith, who was in that particular group, they talked about happiness, the pursuit of happiness, as the ability to acquire the opportunity to do for people that were unable, for whatever reason, to do for themselves. And the assumption is that, you know, the thinking was in the Enlightenment, in the Scottish Enlightenment, that that's really what happiness was all about. And, you know, and I'm kind of supplying a little bit of background evidence here, but there's no question that Jefferson's evidence, Jefferson's upbringing, Jefferson's education was driven by the Scottish Enlightenment. He went to William and Mary, and the president of William and Mary was a student of the Scottish Enlightenment. And, you know, so the general thinking has been that Jefferson's entire formal education was driven by that, but we can't prove any of it, because in 1770, all of Jefferson's notes, his papers, everything, were destroyed in a fire. His mother's home burned down, and all Jefferson's notes, books, and everything were lost. So what that has done is created a vacuum, which meant that people ever since have felt comfortable trying to argue that Jefferson must have meant this and Jefferson meant that and all of that. And the fact is, we've lost the sources that would have told us exactly what Jefferson meant by the things he was saying. But the fact of the matter is, there's enough in the writings of the Enlightenment philosophers to indicate that the pursuit of happiness was directly opposite to the way we interpret it, which is property, and which is the things that come to you, when in fact what they meant was things that you can do for other people. And the assumption was that that really was it all about. And Jefferson, later in the 18th century, this was a particular letter that he wrote in 1786 to his nephew. He was given advice to his nephew. And one of the issues that he got into in that particular piece was what he called the moral sense. And his basic argument is, in that letter, is that equality, and I've always assumed that this is what he meant in the Declaration as well, when he talked about all men being equal. Jefferson believed the basis of equality was the moral sense, conscience, that people innately knew right and wrong, and they didn't have to be told what was right and what was wrong, that they knew it instinctively because it was part of their DNA. Of course, he didn't use that term. But basically, Jefferson referred to this as the moral sense, and everybody had it. Jefferson said it was like any other limb of the body. It improved with exercise. And so Jefferson's advice to his nephew was that you need to read good books. You need to read, very positive fiction, because it increases your sense of feeling and respect and love for your neighbors, for other people. And that's the source of human happiness. And so, Jefferson is really consistent, it seems to me, in this particular issue. And I've always been concerned about it, because why the hell isn't this even mentioned about Jefferson's Declaration of Independence? Instead, everybody takes the meaning from Carl Becker's book on the Declaration of Independence, written in the early 20s, 1922, when Becker says that Jefferson took it directly from Locke. Government. In it, he uses the terms life, liberty, and property. And so the assumption is that Jefferson copied the Declaration directly from Locke, but he couldn't say property for political reasons, so he replaced it with happiness, but he meant property. And this goes right in then, that the purpose of government...
Isn't that a little bit presumptive?
Yeah.
It's like arguing that Jefferson didn't know the word property.
Right. That was the basic argument, that Jefferson was writing a political document for public consumption, and he had to be very politically careful. And therefore, he wanted to avoid even the suggestion that anything about the war for independence or anything about the Declaration of Independence smacked of benefiting the wealthy. And so therefore, he wanted to avoid anything about property. That's the general argument.
This is also, but Bill, this is also a time when he evinces some conflict, at least internal conflict, as touching upon slavery.
Right.
He later makes, his entire life becomes much of it becomes an exercise in hypocrisy as he began to experience considerable financial difficulties.
Right.
Such that the only way he ever made a profit in his entire life was by his slaves. But at that point in time, he was engaging in some, and we know about some language that had to be pulled out because of,
right,
because of the objection of Virginians and South Carolinians and North Carolinians and Georgians regarding slavery.
Right.
But by keeping the word property out, did that have any relationship to the slavery issue?
I've never connected it with that. The section on property, as I remember it, because Jefferson's original first draft of the Declaration is available online. All you got to do is just go to Google it and just type in Jefferson's first draft of the Declaration, and you'll see that toward the very end of the document, there's a huge paragraph pertaining to the issue of slavery, and that's one of the things that Southerners insisted in Congress had to come out. And Jefferson really believed, Jefferson believed that he was forced to make so many changes in the Declaration of Independence that its benefits were gone, that he believed that the Declaration of Independence, as approved, was a failure, because there had been so many, he had been forced to make so many political changes in it to get it passed. But that's the one that most people focus on, is the paragraph on slavery. But if you read that paragraph, he's pinning the cause of slavery on the king, on Great Britain. And his argument is that it's Great Britain that brought boatloads of captured Africans to the New World, that it's their fault, and that this is one of the greatest evils that the king has foisted on the colonies, is to inflict us with slavery. And now we've got hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, I guess is what he says, of Africans who were brought here against their will, Well, how are we supposed to keep peace? What are we supposed to do now? And so Jefferson's argument in that paragraph was that this is the greatest evil that England imposed on us, was to saddle us with this racial issue. And of course, the South insisted that every mention of slavery had to come out of the Declaration, or they wouldn't approve it.
But that argument has merit, because a lot of people in this country who don't necessarily know their history are ignorant of the fact that slavery was not merely a Southern institution, that there was slavery in New England, there was slavery mm-hmm. in the Middle Atlantic states, there was slavery in New York and Pennsylvania, and that it was slowly eradicated from those areas and remained persistent because of the nature of the plantation economy
in the South. Right.
In the South. But his argument does have some merit because, mm-hmm. among other things, you know, you and I were talking privately a couple of weeks ago. I found the history of one of my ancestors, the first one to arrive in the United States, or in the colonies, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He arrived in the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1635, and I even found the ship's manifest that has him on it. And I found the name of the ship, and I was able to research the ship. And the name of the ship that landed in the Massachusetts Bay Colony in May of 1635 was the Elizabeth and Anne. Mm-hmm. And what you find out is that prior to bringing religious dissidents to the colonies, which was a sort of form of voluntary transportation as opposed to the involuntary stuff that they would do with criminals, prior to being used to transport religious types, it had primarily been used in the earlier parts of the 17th century as a slave ship in what we now refer to as the Middle Passage,
mm-hmm.
and that one ship had brought hundreds, if not thousands, of enslaved, kidnapped individuals to these shores.
Mm-hmm.
And those were financial benefits that inured not to the colonists, but to the money in England that backed the ships. You know, we need to remember that, for instance, Lloyd's of London, the famous insurer, begins mm-hmm. as basically a group of gamblers sitting in a coffee house called Lloyd's and gambling on the return of various cargo ships from all around the world to the British Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is some historical data to support that idea. Of course, the Dutch were involved, and the Portuguese were involved,
right.
and the Spanish were involved. But there's
also the fact that Virginia was a joint stock company. Example were primarily driven by religious dissenters. The Virginia colony was an investment venture, and they were looking for wealth. And, of course, the assumption was that they would find the kind of wealth that Spain did in Central and South America in gold and silver. Well, there was quickly none here, and it became very obvious very quickly that if the Virginia company investors were going to make money, that ultimately it was going to be from the fact that there were enough settlers over here to provide the labor to generate whatever wealth that was available in new colonies, and that would be agricultural wealth and timber and minerals and that kind of thing. And so a first priority in the Virginia initiative was labor. And labor was basically based on the idea of the indentured servant. And at the beginning, and a friend of mine years ago did this research, but at the beginning, blacks, there was no such thing as slavery in the laws of Virginia. There was only laws regulating the indentured servant system. And blacks and whites were both treated equally as indentured servants. And it's only gradually through the 17th century that you begin to see gradually a separation, a distinction being made between black servants and white servants, until by later in the 17th century, black indentures become much longer than white indentures until they ultimately become permanent. and you have the institution of slavery. In other words, the whole development of the institution of slavery basically revolves around the production, generation, and extraction of wealth. And so, you know, that also supports Jefferson's idea, Jefferson's statement in the Declaration. One of the most fascinating things about Jefferson, and I'm not polished in this, but I am aware that Jefferson made a very, very important, in his mind, distinction between Native Americans and African slaves. And while he never wavered in his support of slavery itself, he looked upon Native Americans as kind of the noble savage idea, that this was civilization at its very beginnings, and this nation had the tremendous potential and the tremendous opportunity to rediscover and actually watch the development of civilization as it developed from the noble savage idea into the emergence of the modern world in the Indian. He felt that the presence of Native Americans was a real asset that this country had, if we really knew how to benefit from it.
And you can see some of that in the attitude that he instilled in Lewis and Clark in the Corps of Discovery when he became president and sent them off on their expedition.
Right.
On the other hand, then, how do we square that? How do we square that with the merciless Indian savages language in the Declaration?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure, because that does seem extremely inconsistent from what he writes in his private papers about Native Americans. And of course, again, I mean, if you insert the idea, the political issue into that. Many people did look upon the Native Americans as merciless savages because of what was happening on the frontier, and of course the idea was that some of the major internal controversies that occurred in late colonial America and indeed into the new nation itself were tied up with the fact that governments were located in the East. In Virginia, for example, the seat of government was in the East, and most of the people coming in as settlers were driven west because the best land was gone, and they were exposed to the Indians, and they looked to government to protect them from the Indians, and it wasn't happening.
And in point of fact, the English had struck a deal with tribal peoples basically beyond the Allegheny front and beyond what was then the frontier, saying, we're not going to let the colonies expand any further. Mm-hmm. And that's part and parcel of the language about, let me see, I had it here. Has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. You gotta wonder, he and Adams and Franklin are credited with authoring this, but it is a propaganda document.
Mm-hmm. It sure is, yeah.
And of course, using that drives little white wingers into paroxysms of white, and I do mean white hot rage. But it is. It's not a legal document. It is not expressing any form of governance. It's merely saying we're done, and mm-hmm. and here are the reasons why.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, the history of the colonies, be it the Dutch in New York or the English elsewhere, were of because the language here is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Well, that's basically what the white people did mm-hmm. to Indian groups.
Mm-hmm.
They killed without regard to age or sex.
Exactly. They did.
They in the name of God, they killed them all and let God sort them out.
Right.
And so the natives responded in kind.
Well, see, and that's one of the things that a lot of people don't like to address either, is that much of the savagery that the Indians practiced, they learned from whites.
Yeah, right down to the taking of scalps.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So
I mean, that's a troubling paragraph if one understands what his attitude toward indigenous people would be later, but he's a deeply conflicted man any way you slice it. So as we wrap things up here, let me go back and ask make one thing clear, if I may.
Sure.
You mentioned Adam Smith. There is somewhat of an irony in the fact that The Wealth of Nations, which he considered to be one of his lesser works, would be published in the same year as part of the Scottish Enlightenment as the Declaration of Independence.
Right, it was.
So there's really no evidence to suggest that any of these Enlightenment thinkers who wrote and ratified the Declaration of Independence had Adam Smith to go by in terms of
no.
any idea of what he would that same year call capitalism.
No, not at all. And in fact, Adam Smith's reputation at the time in 1776, Adam Smith's reputation was based on his Essay on Moral Sentiments, which he wrote years earlier, several years before the Wealth of Nations. And in that Moral Sentiments piece, the person of Adam Smith begin to see the Scottish Enlightenment in that Adam Smith. And he's talking about the same thing that Jefferson referred to as a moral sense. He's talking about moral sentiments. What is natural in man, and what must man learn? And all of that. And it's a challenge to the idea, the Enlightenment idea of Locke, that everything man knows or learns comes from his environment, that he's born with no innate knowledge at all, that he's born as a tabula rasa, a blank slate, and that everything that man comes to know and becomes is based on what he learns. In other words, there's nothing innate. And the Scottish Enlightenment people refused to accept that. And one of the people that wrote on it was Adam Smith in his Essay on Moral Sentiments. And he took issue with Locke. And so to insist, as Becker does, that Jefferson is Locke, and then take it and run with it from there, so that the pursuit of happiness becomes the pursuit of opportunity, And the inalienable rights they're talking about is the right to pursue wealth and profit and all the things that contribute to the development of capitalism, is really a manipulation of history. But that's the people that did that had the power to impose it. It's what's in our textbooks. And whatever we know, whatever our young people learn about Jefferson comes from their textbooks, and ultimately it's based on what Carl Becker's conclusion was in 1922. And all of this stuff about Jefferson and moral sentiments and the kind of education he received and all the rest of it. And Madison was the same. Madison went to Princeton. But the president of Princeton, when he was there, was a student of Francis Hutcheson, who was in the he was in the Scottish Enlightenment as well. And Madison got it. So there's quite a bit of Enlightenment thinking in Madison also. And you can see that in his Constitution. So and all of this has been lost. I mean, you would think to 242 years after the Declaration of Independence that everything to know about it we should know by now. The fact of the matter is there's darn little of it we really know. Because most of our history has been imposing a self-serving interpretation of it on society.
An ends-based rationalization of a runaway capitalism.
Yeah.
Because to hear
a
Republican
writing our own history to justify where we want it to be.
Yeah, it's not history at all. It's argument.
Yeah.
And so that you know, to hear a modern typical Republican, you would think that there was a through line that ran straight from Thomas Jefferson and Adam Smith right up to Ayn Rand.
Exactly.
But even Adam Smith's capitalism is not the sanctified greed and avarice and self-centeredness of Ayn Rand.
No, it sure isn't. And the irony is neither is John Locke. I mean, the most interesting thing is everybody focuses on Locke's idea of the state of nature and natural rights and all of that. And conservatives use that as a justification for limiting government to the protection of unalienable rights. And the protection of unalienable rights is property. And they go to Locke for it because Locke argues that, you know, that life itself is property, that you have been, that God has given you. And only since God gave you life, only God can take it away. And liberty is the freedom to pursue property. So Locke argues in the second treatise that all of it becomes a facet of property. Therefore, property clearly, naturally, is one of the inalienable rights that Jefferson was talking about. But I'm convinced there wasn't. Not at all. Jefferson was insistent on this idea of conscience. And he talked about education as being a way that man is able to develop his mind in order to manipulate situations so that he can rationalize into the directions he wants to go in and not have to do what he knows is right. And Madison picks up on that in Federalist Number 10 because Madison's talking about the difference between man when he sits alone in his chamber, in his closet, as Madison says, and when he's in groups. Madison's idea is that we become the prisoner of those who agree with us, of factions. And therefore, pressure is put on us to go with the crowd. Jefferson says many of the things that we do, Madison says many of the things that we do and say in a crowd as part of a mob are not the things we would do and say if we were alone.
And Twitter proves that in all its wondrous horror.
Yeah.
The way people behave in a Twitter mob is not the way they behave.
No.
On a day-to-day basis. And I think and see, you can say the same thing with Trump's supporters.
And what Madison believed was that man's conscience, man's sense of right and wrong, is a sense that becomes dominant and it competes with self-interest in man's when man's private, when he's alone. And man is swayed in his decisions by what he knows to be right. But when he gets in a group, that moral sense, that idea of conscience, which drives men in the right direction, people with the same interests he has, and Madison—that's what Madison meant by faction. And he said, "What you got? You can't eliminate them." But he says it's sown into the nature of man. We got to deal with it. So therefore, the Constitution that Madison puts together is a document based on the idea that if you could create competing factions and force each faction to compete with others, then what you do is prevent there from being a faction that takes over the whole, that takes total power. And that's the whole idea of separation of powers and checks and balances, and that's what's being lost now with Trump. Because Congress's inability to do anything,
or its unwillingness,
is creating open season for Trump to do anything he wants.
And here we sit on the 4th of July, 2018, and what is it? There are seven United States senators, Republicans all, engaged in closed-door meetings in Russia?
In Russia, right. And the only thing we know about it is because of what Russian media has told us. God almighty, it's incredible.
It's breathtaking in its scope. Well, let me ask you, because if anybody can answer this, I have complete faith that it's you. And let me share a couple of notes with you too. Jack in Shreveport said, thanks so much to Dr. Bill and you. I'm not part. It's all you, Dr. Bill, for such an interesting way to spend the first part of this evening's program. And then Horst wrote in and says, say hey to Dr. Bill. Since you guys are both online together, if an opportunity moment arises, I'd just like to pass along a happy Independence Day, such as our current era will afford, to you and him jointly. I should be asleep, but at the midpoint of my convalescence, I find my sleeping hours almost completely upside down. So I'm going to content myself with seeing if your dulcet conversational tones help lull me to sleep this morning. Best wishes all around. Your pal Horst. I think we've been fainted with damn praise there, Bill.
Oh, I think that's wonderful. And what I was going to say is, I taught history for so long, I've put more people to sleep, so I hope I can with Horst.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So if anybody can answer this question, you can. Since we have pointed out the departure from what you say the original meaning of the Declaration was, to what it has been bent and twisted into being, mm-hmm. can you offer up any sort of an alternative universe vision of what this country might have been had the things that the people who ratified it and wrote it took for granted, had those understandings carried forward versus what was done to turn it into basically a life support system for commercialism?
I've thought off and on about that particular issue, how things would be different. I've become a fan of Madison and the Constitution, because I really believe that he really believed that his system would work. Not only that it could work, but that it would work. And his idea of driving everybody toward the center, towards moderation, his support is he, along with everybody else at the beginning, was opposed to parties because he equated them with factions. But the fact of the matter is, he becomes the architect of the first challenge to the Federalists in this country, because of opposition to Hamilton. But he's able to envision, and that's what he does and has done in Federalist Number 10, a situation where you can drive people who disagree to deliberate, to negotiate, to compromise, and to focus on the things that they do agree on and build on those in order to work out some of the things that people don't agree on. And I think that that's what he believed that this nation could become. And I've become a fan of that. And I really worry about it because it's being destroyed now. I thought one of the best statements that I've read in a long time was the idea, in opposition to the idea that what's happening now in terms of partisanship and tribalism in politics and all of this and the lack of civility in our society and all of this is proof positive that Madison's system doesn't work. And the response that I read to that, and I can't remember who wrote it, is that no, it doesn't at all. What it proves is that the caliber, the quality of statesmanship that are necessary to make it work is not here in the country anymore. We don't have people that are worthy of Madison's system. And what we've got to do is find ways to develop those people again. And that, and I tend to believe that. I really do. And it, maybe it's because
and that
I
begins
want to.
And that begins with education.
Yes, it does. Real education, true education, not indoctrination. And we've been unwilling to try that. We educate the wealthy, but we're afraid to educate the masses for fear of what they might do.
Yeah, we educate the wealthy nearer to the way that the framers were educated than anyone else. But the non-wealthy are there's that you know the phrase that's coming, the one that I love so much from Jefferson.
Yeah.
The non-wealthy are raked from the rubbish.
Yep.
And given just enough education to make them compliant.
To make them compliant, exactly. And one of the things that bothers me most is the emphasis on online education that we see today. Because the fact of the matter is the wealthiest people are not allowing their children to be educated with online classes and online programs. That's being given to the rest of us. Because it's cheap and it creates compliancy because it's driven by right and wrong answers. And
as opposed to critical thinking.
As opposed to critical thinking, exactly. And the wealthy people know that. And the fact of the matter is when the wealthiest people begin to put their children in educational situations where the major portion of the instruction is online, then I think we'll have arrived at something. But until then, you know, the fetish about online education is basically because it's cheaper. It's cheaper not only in terms of the delivery of the information. The very nature of online suggests that education is something you deliver. It's not something you engage or that you develop.
Or that you experience.
Young people develop. Exactly. It's something that comes from somebody else to you, and that's indoctrination. And that's what drives online education. And unfortunately, that's the definition of education that we're giving to people. And what it does is it permits larger and larger classes, fewer and fewer quality teachers. And instructors become more managers of crowd. Class managers, if you will.
And, you know, Jack in Shreveport just pointed out something as well. Online education also gets rid of the college campus as a place of protest, dissent, and discussion.
It certainly does. Bob, it certainly does. So, you know, I mean, I think this whole thing, I've always believed, and this is obviously my background as well, but I obviously believe that education is the answer, and I think the founders did too. The irony of Madison's 10, and I think I think this is so underappreciated in Madison. He believed that the system itself would help us develop the caliber of people necessary to make this system work, because he felt that if you elected the right people, people who could put their self-interest aside on the, you know, in favor of the public interest. And the way you develop that is that if you get the right people who live by that in office, then the people who are actually practicing what the system requires will help to educate voters in terms of what they need to look for in candidates. And that process will be a constant educational process between elected representatives and voters. And because more and more representatives are functioning the way they need to be functioned, putting the public interest first, then that's going to educate the voters on the kind of people they need to continue to keep electing. And the result is going to be that that system will snowball and it'll become stronger and stronger and stronger. And that's the basis of Madison's commitment to participatory government and to republicanism. He believed that that actually will work.
And it's idealistic
as hell.
To one extent, it did work, because you wind up with autodidacts like Lincoln. To another extent, it failed, because the factionalism that would just turn our political system into a hot mess was already well underway by 1824 and the rise of the Jacksonian Democrats. But also the liberal policies of FDR and Truman and how we treated veterans and the creation of the GI Bill in the aftermath of the Second World War liberalized access to higher education in a way that did create a certain late 20th century renaissance. And as quickly as you get to Ronald Reagan, with a through line through Richard Nixon, you can see in real time the entire system being pulled down because it had been determined to be too damn dangerous. Whether it's Nixon walking the halls of the White House half out of his mind, mumbling to portraits, wasted on barbiturates and booze, or Reagan talking to his hair follicles because he was losing his mind, and then through that to W. Bush and God Almighty now, there's a common understanding among Republicans that education is not a net good for the republic, but rather that it is a net negative for the corporate state.
I think that the progressive movement in the early 20th century was the best shot at the educated population that the founders believed in and talked about. But the very point of the fact that progressivism was the product of quality education being delivered to the wrong people. I really think that's the basis of opposition to progressivism, that people believe that if you bring quality education to the masses and aren't careful who gets it, you're going to be dealing with one progressive program after the other. And people are going to start to raise questions about the unfairness of the system and all of that. So you got to be very careful who gets it and who doesn't.
And the next thing you know, poor people will be eating Alaskan king crab legs and giving Louis Gohmert to SAD.
Right.
Oh, my God. Dr. Bill, this has been magnificent. Thank you for giving me a big chunk of your evening.
I appreciate you asking me to call because especially on this day, I believe that this is a day that the things that Jefferson did and again, Jefferson's mind is something that I think is incredible. And I think to do what we've done to him is a shame because we're missing so much in his mind. And again, that doesn't mean he was perfect.
We've Santa Claused him. Okay, that's the term I used for it. Just like we've Santa Claused Martin Luther King Jr. And we remember two or three things they said, and we forget the radicalism that was inherent in the very essence of their beings. And you're right; there were a lot of hypocrisies. There's a lot of stuff to criticize about him, and I have.
I like about him, and the thing I find amazing about Jefferson and Madison as well, is that they continued to learn through their life. One of the most pleasant experiences you can have is to read the exchange of letters between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson once they got back together again after they retired in their later years. Because up until the 90s, the 1790s, up until the split over Hamilton's program, Jefferson and Adams were fast friends. 1790s divided them, and Jefferson, of course, became the head of the opposition party that Madison and Beckley and the others in Congress helped create, the Republican opposition. And for years they didn't speak, and in the later years they did, and they start to reflect on getting old and what it means and what true friendship is and what love is, and what kindness is, and what happiness is. And it's just absolutely the most wonderful exchange between two incredibly bright people, two totally different people, but incredibly, I mean, Adams was arrogant and aggressive and intolerant and
flinty. When we talk about people from New England, we like to use the word flinty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, Dr. Bill, I wish you
that exchange is great, Bob, and I appreciate the opportunity.
I wish you a very happy Independence Day, and I think this country would be far better off if more people spent Independence Day doing a little bit of what we've just done over the course of the last hour.
Bob, I've enjoyed it.
That being the case, let me encourage, while I still have you here, let me just remind people that from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, schedule permitting, you're right here at the Horn. And this is your bread and butter. And people who want to learn more, who want to know more, who have questions, can tune in just like any program on the Horn. It's free. Nobody sends a bill. This is a level of education, and I know how humble you are, and you're probably blushing right now. But this is a level of education you ordinarily can't get anywhere else without coughing up thousands and thousands of dollars. And so if you want to know more about American history, in particular, if you want to know more about the founding of the country, the colonization, the goods and the evils that came of it, if you want to know more about the ratification of the Constitution and the minds and the thoughts that went into it, then join Dr. Bill Monday, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays of every week from 1 to 3 p.m. I guarantee, because see, this is the difference. Dr. Bill is an actual expert who has the years and years of study to prove it, as opposed to maybe other people in that time slot who tell you they're an expert but aren't really. So, Dr. Bill, I will thank you very kindly, and I wish
you
a happy Independence Day. And we'll talk soon. Maybe we need to do this more often.
Oh, this is fun. Thank you, Bob. Right. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care,
Bob. Good night now.
Bye now.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
The one and only Dr. Bill O'Brien. Darlene in Connecticut just sent a note, and Dr. Bill's still connected so he can hear me. Awesome program with Dr. Bill. What a treat for the fourth. I spoke with Dr. Bill years ago on his program about currency in the colonial era. Please tell him I said hello. I wish I'd had him for an instructor in college, but school's in session now with you and Dr. Bill, and that's pretty cool. Thank you, Darlene. Thank you very, very kindly. And I can't emphasize enough that, once again, there's just not a lot of radio out there like this. Just like what we're about to start, there isn't a lot of radio out there like this. And what I'm talking about in that regard is 4th of July on the front porch. It is a free-for-all. Everybody's welcome to kick in, join in, be part of the extraordinary, ordinary roundtable conversation. If you would like to be part of it this evening, then by all means, send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc, Sparky Dunk. The whole idea was first brought up by our buddy Matt up in Humboldt. So, Matt, if you're out there, this would be the time. Jump right in, anybody and everybody, because, like I said, we do a lot of things here at the Horn that aren't like anything anybody else is doing. We clown around, we carry on, but we can also get deadly serious and occasionally downright scholastic, as you just heard. But God Almighty, that conversation could have gone on for 6 hours. And in some instances, private conversations I've had with Dr. Bill, it has. I mean, you're talking about a wealth of knowledge and understanding that is not based upon, as he noted, what somebody else said about something, but is based upon his analysis of the original documents themselves, the philosophies that went behind it, the personalities involved. And there's no replacing that. There's no replacement for that. So at 24 minutes past the hour on this 4th of July, this Independence Day 2018, this 242nd anniversary of the Declaration of the Independence of this country, we're going to fire up the Extraordinary Ordinary Roundtable. And I will say before we do that, that we have $360 to raise this evening to get in it, to get even, come up to even with the first 4 days fundraising of the month of July. So that's where we, that's where things stand. Gosh, 36 new $10 a month subscribers would be freaking awesome. But anyway, it happens. Everybody gets thanked and everybody is appreciated. However you go about keeping this little independent broadcasting experiment on the air. So, hey, Sparky.
Hello, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
Well, I'm sitting here with the bucket cooler on. And we got a Delta breeze blowing today, so it's fairly cool.
It is. It is a. It's a real tolerable 77 degrees here in the Fabulous Horn Studio, the south-facing, lots of window glass, Fabulous Horn Studio. Better than it was last night. I think I went through about six bottles of water between 6 and 9 p.m. last night when it was 89, 90 degrees in here.
The only bad part about a Delta breeze is it blows all the smoke from any fires north.
Well, let me ask you about this this cooler affair. I saw one photo of it. Does it actually spew water onto the floor?
No, not if you. Well, you don't have a big freezer.
No, I don't.
So.
I mean, I thought I saw a photo of it with water all around it or something.
No, I got a. This is a prototype that I made. I've got the parts coming for. To make the styrofoam inserts that fit inside of the bucket. And then it should work better than it does now. But I'm gonna go. It comes with three of them, so I'm got enough to make two more bucket coolers.
Have you measured how much it drops the temperature there in the man cave?
Oh, it doesn't. It just blows on me. It's not going to affect the rest of the cave, man. The cave's too big. The doors are open.
Okay, so it's more of a personal kind of.
Yeah, when the temperature is like 90 degrees or just around 90, it makes it bearable sitting out here at the computer.
Okay.
But the camera. But you know.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is I was kind of intrigued
if the wind shifts and it comes from the north, like it's probably going to do in a few more days, then we go back over double digits, and then you can't stand it out here.
Okay. Well, the reason I was asking is I was trying to figure out if it would be something that could possibly help augment things here in the. In the Fabulous Horn Studios.
Yeah, if you had a way to. Well, you got a regular ice chest?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you could buy a couple bags of ice, or, you know, for the ice chest, bring them home. Bucket coolers, I'm going to make, I'm going to put the vents higher through the foam. So that there's a place where if I use bag ice, it can melt down and it will just fill up with water. And you'll have water in a bag or something.
Okay.
But right now I'm using frozen gallon milk jugs. And I don't have the insert, the styrofoam insert for the bucket yet. I won't get those till July 9th. But I am getting testing, going to test out a USB fan. On the next bucket cooler I make, because it's right next to my computer, I can just plug it in and see how it works. Right now I got this old fan that my dad had made in about an 8-inch piece of pipe for something. I don't know what it was for, but it was in the rocks up and we found it. This was all my minions' idea to start making these bucket coolers.
Well, he's an enterprising little guy.
Yeah, well, he's gone on vacation this week. His sister had a baseball tournament to go to up in Alturas, up in the northern, far northeast of the state. So, a softball league. I mean, they're the all-stars. So they've been up there all week. It runs through the 5th. Parents took the week off and they loaded up the trailer and skedaddled.
Okay.
But I just wanted to tell you the 66 FMS maintenance squad here in the man caves is ready to receive drones in the war.
Are you now?
Yeah, if anybody's flying them around this area to explore the almond orchards and the plum prune orchards and the walnut orchards.
Anybody you might be flying them for reconnaissance during the Civil War here.
Yeah, you might want to see my black neighbors that are out in the pasture. Cattle ranch, John.
Mm.
Angus cattle ranch. So, and then he's starting prune orchards now. So I'm surrounded
by agriculture. There you go, buddy.
Hey, I tell you what, before they ever turn into prunes, they're daggum plums, and they're delicious that way too.
Mm. Bob, how you doing?
I'm doing good, John. It's awful good to have you back, John Bredevoe from Blue Dot. Down there on the in the Texas Gulf Coast country. I'm just tickled pink that you decided to come back and hang out with us. Welcome.
Well, man, I had to come back over here. And I got a bone to pick with you, buddy.
Oh, what have I done now?
Oh, shit, man. You done screwed up my day.
Oh, no.
There you go. Yep. I went down, did my rant. I think Sparky was listening to part of it there when I did it live on my Discord thing there. But got it all up there, put it on my computer, started uploading it, and... Then promptly sat down and got my iPad, tuned into your show, was listening like I was listening to the History Channel, completely forgot about my video. It was sitting over there, I guess, ready to post any time. And I was sitting there just immersed in y'all's conversation. That gentleman was very, very knowledgeable.
Oh dear! I've got the Blue Dot Nation pissed at me now.
Yeah, no, yeah.
I sincerely don't want that, John.
Now, wait a minute. I saw your video post before a while back.
Yeah, it posted right before 7 o'clock when I jumped up to get my Mac up back here and get ready to call in is when I noticed I forgot to hit the post button and so hit it immediately. And then shared it to my fan page and to a few other pages that I admin on. And then sent my son off to the job here. There's about 100 groups that need sharing to. You'll go do your job. So, but I was so immersed in the conversation that was going on. And it really was. It was like tuning into the History Channel. I learned a lot.
Well, you know, we overlook a lot of stuff, John. We take it for granted, as Dr. Bill pointed out. You know, when those guys with the quill pens wrote Pursuit of Happiness, well, actually, it would be Pursuit of Happiness.
Yes, and thank goodness they did, Bob, because had they used the word property, can you imagine the fight that would be going on today?
It would have started then and never finished. It would have been going on... Well, you know, this country probably wouldn't have made it to 1860.
Yeah, yeah. The way it was written, and you can see it in a lot of writers who are good writers that can explain an emotion, leaving it up to the reader to interpret. And that's how come I've always kind of thought that the Constitution is more like a living document instead of set in stone, and this is what it is, because of the evolution of what we consider the pursuit of happiness to be. And other, you know, that all men are created equal. When they wrote that, sure enough, they did not believe that they were slave owners themselves, you know. And even Abe Lincoln he did not believe that total equality between the races.
Oh no, he had to be talked out of his
the necessity.
Well, he had to be talked out of his back to Africa idea that he'd signed on to by Frederick Douglass. Yeah. You know, Frederick Douglass met with him and said, I'm going back to Africa. Africa's not my home. I was born here.
Yeah. it's that constant. That's what I mean. Our whole history is a constant battle for a reinterpretation of what our founding documents say. And if you're going to hold them to the fire and hold up to what it says, and of course it gets debated back and forth, and there we are, you know, here we are, 2018, we're doing the same thing.
Exactly. They're only, the White Wing, John, are only constitutional originalists as long as it suits them. Because if they were really a constitutional originalist, the D.C. versus Heller that Fat Dead Tony Scalia wrote would have said everybody's free to own a freaking musket.
Yep.
Because that's what there was back then. But originalism goes out the window when they want to say that Americans have the right to own a goddamn semi-automatic machine gun with a bump stock and a 1,000 rounds of ammunition.
I have to worry about those drones, Bob. I think I should be entitled to a damn rocket launcher.
It could be argued
to that point.
Yeah, just a little, just a little heat-seeking SAM installation right there, right there
nothing
next to
major.
Yeah.
It's not like I want nukes, Bob. You know, it's that argument, and I'll tell you what, the arguments range. I posted a simple little thing on my Facebook page with my flag, and oh Lord. I got an overwhelmingly good response, but it sparked a lot of conversations in there that weren't pretty. And
we are
all still interpreting things through our own paradigm, the way we all look at things differently.
Oh, without a doubt, and you would have to concede, I think, John, that the framers of the Constitution, Madison, Hamilton, I'm no big Hamilton fan, you'd have to concede that they were complete and utter clueless morons living in a bubble to think that they were not anticipating what this country would be decades and centuries out. That's the only reason you write a Constitution. You don't write a Constitution if you're going to change the government, 3 weeks from Tuesday.
No, this is something they wanted to set in, down in basic stone as to what our foundations are. But the interpretations of those is what I was talking about.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's what I'm saying. If it can't grow, and if it can't change, and if it can't take into account the needs of the future, there's no point in having it.
That's right. Because, those paradigms change over the time. As they should, because like I say, the fight ain't over. Because as I always say, we're not living in that movie. You've seen those futuristic movies where we're all aliens and humans and all this. We're all united in a utopian society. Well, those are wonderful movies. We're not going to get there unless we solve these problems. Yeah. So.
No, and there's we may just not get there. I joke a lot about, having been born in 1963, I was kind of made this little, that there were certain promises made that there would be jetpacks and helium-filled pants and, all kinds of neat and groovy stuff.
I'm waiting on my George Jetson car.
So that Mrs. Britovo can take your wallet from you and leave you holding the $1 bill.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right. As long as I got that dog and that treadmill, I'll be good. Don't worry.
Been on it for years.
Yes, sir.
Jane, stop this crazy thing.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, I would like to see us. I joke about getting to that Star Trek future.
Yes.
But it looks more like we're getting to one of the, we're getting to much, we're approaching a Blade Runner future instead.
That's what I've always said. I don't want to enter into that Mad Max society, and there are people that would just eat that up, that think that's what we're going to do. I got into a very heated discussion last night, right before I was supposed to call on to another show that I was really wanted to call into and participate in. And I got a phone call right at 7 o'clock, and it was an old friend of mine, We retired from the same Army depot, and he is a staunch Republican. He is a biker for Trump, and it started out a nice little conversation, and progressively got louder. But it was a nice ending at the end of the phone call. We both agreed, you know, to disagree. He had to run off and listen to Judge Wino on Fox, and that's his girlfriend, he said. So there's his problem.
My God, if that's your girlfriend, that's a fine argument for living in a cave and being a hermit.
I mean to tell you, I asked Judge Wino, oh, that's not what she is. She's a good. I said, no, there's video of her running out in the woods, drunk on her butt, yelling for Hillary somewhere. You know, it's not the vision I want to see on the Supreme Court, buddy. Because he was kind of serious. Well, he could pick her for Supreme Court. Oh no, he couldn't, because we're not that stupid yet. That even the Republicans would accept that. But,
he's got a list of 25 from the Federalist Society that he says he's narrowed down to 6, and we're all going to have to tune in to the Donald J. Trump reality show on Monday to find out who the third, second, and first runners up are, and then who is Miss or Mr. Supreme Court Justice 2018.
Who is going to get the rose? Everybody, they're going to be hanging on the edge of their seats. I find it very disgusting. I'm on that. I wish there was just something we could do, just stand our ground, delay it, block it, do whatever. But I don't see it. They have the numbers, you know.
Well, I mean, there is something. The framers of the Constitution were pretty good, and when they were putting those checks and balances in, there are a lot of minute little tools that can be used. But you have to be willing to use them,
yes.
And I don't know that Chuck Schumer can pull that consensus solidarity off, because he's dealing with Joe Donnelly in Indiana, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, the noodle spined Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, and my own, oh God, it grieves me to say it, Joe Manchin,
right.
And Joe, you know, back as I told people back in the day when he was a local politician, a state politician, Joe never missed a chance to go and have a big plate of beans at the bean dinner with the Friends of Fetuses.
You bet, you bet. Politics, baby.
And poor Susan Collins is, I mean, honest to Pete.
Yep.
That woman, I would not let that woman out of the house. With the family cow to go and sell it, she'd wind up trading it for magic beans.
You know, there's some of them, you wonder how in the hell they're still in office. You know, how is this happening? You know.
Well, she said she would absolutely not vote for any nominee who demonstrated a hostility to Roe versus Wade.
Yes, I did hear her say that.
Well, you realize what that sets up, though, John. That means that whoever goes up there, when they say, Judge, how do you feel about Roe v. Wade? Well, Senator, I can't answer that question because that might be an issue that comes before the court, and I can't prejudge any issues. So, but boy, I sure do believe in some stare decisis, or stare decisis is what they call it. I sure do believe in that a lot, and you know, old John Roberts over there, he says he's just going to call balls and strikes, and then he goes out and strikes down the biggest part of the Civil Rights Act. So, but I can't answer any questions about that.
Yeah.
And so Susan Collins goes, oh, well, he didn't say anything bad about Roe v. Wade, so I guess I'm going to vote for him like I always do.
Yeah. She'll dance around that until it's time to vote, and then she'll vote for him. And,
Because the bottom line is you do not get on that Federalist Society list
unless you're already preordained to that you know, overturning Roe v. Wade.
Precisely.
Or you wouldn't be on that list. You know, you wouldn't be on that list. So he doesn't have to ask them. That answer has already been made. And so I don't know. I'm worried about that a lot because it's going to change the court for a long time, and it's going to impact so many things.
Well, you mind if I worry you about some more stuff? I mean,
shit! Just go ahead, and lay it on me, and beat me with a stick.
Well, I mean, you do such a good job of providing, you know, positive reinforcement. And let's get out there and let's form that blue wave. And I'm with you 100% on that.
Yeah, but I'm a cheerleader.
Well, I would never say that. No, we need people doing what you're doing.
Right.
I'm just part of the. When people say, "Oh, look, we got over the barbed wire fence," I go, "Yeah, but there's a whole bunch of spikes in pits right ahead of you." Okay.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is we're there's a little bit of danger involved because we are focusing so tightly on Roe v. Wade. And I don't mean to discount the importance of it, because frankly, the reason for getting rid of Roe v. Wade is to get rid of any concept of the right of privacy.
Yeah.
And we are all touched by that.
How to buy a congressman?
Right.
How to buy a congressman? Citizens United is just a peek at what you'll be able to see.
Well, exactly. And by laser beam focusing on Roe v. Wade, we're kind of. Diminishing the importance of things like the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, what is called by the white wing birthright
really
citizenship.
They try to make that issue a hot button issue for everybody because they will, they know that their masses are going to come out for that one issue. They may not come out for civil rights or voting rights or women, they're going to come out for abortion. That's where their power is. Because everybody rallies around that, because they've made the conversation, well, if you're not pro-life, well, you just want to kill babies.
Put them on cornflakes in the morning.
That's it. Yeah. There's no middle of the road with that side. You're either for saving that. I mean, before it's fertilized. If you have sex and there you go, well, there you go, Bob. We take over from here. It's just ridiculous.
It's terrifying.
You can only hold on to hope that as they interpret the Constitution, as they should, that they judge the way it's supposed to be. But it's beyond that. It's a political issue. It's a moral issue. It's every issue that the right wants to hang on to.
So, well, we sort of got sidetracked, and that's the way these kind of conversations go. But we were talking about, is there any way to stop them? And the fact of the matter is, there is. But Chuck Schumer would have to keep his entire caucus together, and he'd have to get at least one, and I would say two, Republicans with him to caucus and to say, henceforward, I'm caucusing with the Democrats. At that point in time, Mitch McConnell isn't majority leader anymore. And Mitch McConnell cannot set the agenda, and Mitch McConnell cannot even get a quorum. And if you can stop a quorum between now and January, then there ain't no hearings, but there ain't no anything else. The Senate just simply refuses to do business.
Well, I'm all for whatever idea can keep that postponed until after November. As Mitch McConnell said, let the people decide, let the voters decide what they want to do. I think right now in this country, I don't think the voters want to see that idiot appoint another one.
The sad thing is, I saw a poll where NBC News had partnered with, get this, SurveyMonkey, because nothing says reliable data like information from a company called SurveyMonkey. But something like 60% of the American people want the hearings to be held before the election, according to SurveyMonkey.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they didn't call me.
Yeah, nor me.
Did you get a call on that one?
No. Dadgummit, if only we had landlines here.
Yeah, I'm telling you, that's what they cut all them phone calls right out in the middle of there. They shoot them at them with a gun, I think. I don't know what it is.
Well, I think SurveyMonkey mostly works online.
Is that right?
So,
bullets.
Yeah, I mean, that's one maggot tells another maggot tells another maggot.
Yeah. Well, like I said, they didn't contact me and ask my opinion. Nobody has. I don't know. Bob, I sit out here and I try to soak up as much as I can and watch what's happening, and it tears you apart. That not enough people. This is what my problem here is in the last few days, Bob, is that we had a special election down here to replace old Blake Barenthal, and we really pushed hard for Eric Olguin. Of course, our district is heavily gerrymandered, But I watched the results that night, and in my whole district, we had 36,000 people vote. Well, the population of Corpus Christi by itself, the bluest part of my whole district, is 305,000 people. And we ended up getting about 19,000 votes. We lost to a Republican, you know, because it was a beautiful Saturday. The beach was fine, and people were out at the island. You know, it tears me
And I'm sure every bit of that was by design, John.
Yes. That's what we keep on pushing down here in Texas. This is not a red state. We are a non-voting state. Our Democrats are convinced that, or our liberals are convinced that the conservatives have it locked up. Why go try? Let's go to the beach, and or to the lake, or wherever that is, what they want to go do, or to the dance hall, or whatever. But there's always something more important to do than vote. You know, my belief is that I think we ought to have it during the week. I think it ought to be a paid day off if you come back with a slip saying you voted. If you don't come back with a slip saying you voted, you took the day off without pay. But that's the way out. You know, you can't. You know, it's like having to pay people to get off their ass and go vote.
Vote by mail. You can never make it any easier.
Down here in Texas, baby, they're still trying to make it. You know. Not that easy.
Well, that's all I've ever vote by.
Yeah.
Ballot comes a couple weeks before the primary, the general election. You mark your ballot, send it in.
We like to get out and try to early vote. They have polling places open that you can go take your early voting. So we try to get that out of the way and whatnot. This past one I didn't because I was involved in a lot of other stuff. So I voted on the day of the election. And, But that the guy that got elected, he's only in there for 4 months, baby. We got election coming up in November, and, you know, it starts all over again. And there'll only be two names on the ballot, not nine. So
that probably had something to do with it, but...
It did, because it was a special election. There was no, you know, no primary, nothing. If you were qualified to run, you were on there. So we ended up with two Republicans and seven Democrats, independent and libertarian, which dilutes the vote.
Well, all third parties do.
Yep.
And I don't.
For the ideals, you know, the Bernie bots, you know, the ideals that we fight for are great ideas. But if you want to do that, you get in the Democratic Party, you change it. We're a two-party system. One of those two is going to win. And if we keep doing that to ourselves, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot. I'm tired of hobbling around.
Well, I'm right there with you, and the thing is, having been raised by a pair of parents who were teenagers in the Great Depression, who were part of the war. You know, my mother worked in the war industry in Maryland. My father went into the South Pacific, as I mentioned. All of their families around them. I got family that did not come back. That I never got
right to
meet, so I was raised by FDR Democrats, and
which have a base a different value system than you know it depends on where we are in history, where we're born, and what we're going through, what the world is going through. That is what we're going to hold on to. If you lived through the Depression, you know the value of a dollar, and you're very usually very thrifty and.
My mother could squeeze a penny till Lincoln screamed.
Sheesh, I mean to tell you.
But
and even in my lifetime, my wife and I were just talking to my kids that when my wife and I got married, I was a young sailor, and pay wasn't that great. And we remember hanging on to them pop bottles because you got a deposit on those things. And that was like a savings account. You had them pop bottles over there you could go cash in. It wasn't great times, you know, that was in the 70s. And, you know, and the people talking about the Depression, you can just imagine what they, you know. But it is. You have to, when you're talking to somebody, you have to understand where they're coming from, what they lived through in life, you know, to understand what brought them to where they're at.
Without a doubt. And, you know, my parents would transmit their generation's knowledge to me. Mm-hmm. And, for instance, they told me about what it was like living with rationing during the Second World War. Can you imagine, let's say something awful, you know, we got into something like that again. Can you imagine asking a certain segment of this population to go without avocado toast?
You know, I've always said for a long time that I'm very kind of nostalgic, although I'm not that old to dip back into World War II. I love big band music, swing music. That era was I love history a lot like that. And that time during World War II has just always been fascinating to me to learn from. But I also tell people I believe it was the last war that the United States came together, you know, and supported the war effort, you know, almost 100%. After World War II, going into Korea, Vietnam, you know, society changed. They were tired of it, and things were bad.
Well, and it was they weren't the same wars.
No, these were totally different wars. You know, World War II, they always say that, well, that's a front line war. You know where the enemy, there's the front line. We're going up this way, boys. Let's go. You know, we went into Korea and Vietnam. You had war all around you. It was an airborne war. You know, you got dropped off at an LZ in the middle of the jungle, and that's where the war was. You know.
And you know, I remember during the Reign of Error, John, when W was president. How we made sport of him, because he was there in the Champaign unit of the Texas Air National Guard, protecting the Rio Grande from the Viet Cong Air Force, which of course didn't even have one in Vietnam. But now, and it's a lesson I'm learning as I get older. I will never again think that it cannot get any worse. Because we went from a guy who at least, you know, he didn't show up all the time and didn't quite get flight certified that time and maybe went AWOL a little bit. But, you know, he did show up and learn to fly an airplane a little bit.
Right.
Now we've got a guy in office, you know, bone spurs.
He's got a medal for making up his bed or something, you know. That whenever I see him in that picture with his mom and daddy and him in his uniform there at that military school, I can remember what it was. It scratches me a bit the wrong way.
It takes the hide right off of you, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. You know, I say it all the time. He was a coward then. He's a coward now. And he has never stood up for this country. You can see you haven't seen his taxes because he didn't pay taxes. And nobody wants to pay taxes. Nobody does. But that's what gives us our military. That's what builds this country. And that's what pays for everything. And we all want to figure out a way to pay less taxes. But to just say, screw you, you know, and you want to be president of this country, then no, I don't think so, buddy. You know, let me see your taxes. And he ain't shown him yet. He never will.
But he's part of a certain generation of right wing so-called patriots. We should have seen this coming, okay?
Heavy on the
because when America listened for 30 years to a man who got out of Vietnam by claiming he had an infected hair and pus-filled cyst on his ass. That probably should have been a damn clue.
Some flag should have gone off. Well, you know, that's how come I never let Ted Nugent off the hook. Anytime that man's name comes up, the guy that pissed his pants. The one that shit his pants so he wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. Because that's what he said in the Rolling Stone ad. I take the man at his word. You know, he was a coward then, he's a coward now. Now he's on the board of the NRA, buddy. You know, Ted's moving up there. He's another fake patriot. You know, they watched a lot of war movies. They watched a lot of war movies, so they know what they're talking about. Yes, sir.
John,
yes.
Where was your induction center?
I went to Orlando, Florida. I was a very lucky fella because the place had just been opened up. You know, I was going to go to Great Lakes. Well, that's great, you know, but no. My boot camp was, there were several things about my company, Duncan. We were the last company at Orlando in the Navy to carry rifles. We were the last 18-week company. The company coming behind us was a 9-week company. They cut boot camp in half. They don't have to go through rifle training or nothing like that. They don't have to carry rifles. They don't have to take care of them in the barracks and nothing. And you don't think we gave them hell every time they went out to the grinder to march? Oh, hell no. We got out there, baby, and marched right at them. I don't care how many obliques we had to take. We would run right to get their ass off my grinder. And we gave them hell. But, yeah, that was 71. So
I went in the service in 70.
In
1970, my induction center was in Oakland, California, where you went to your physicals and everything.
My induction center was in New Orleans.
Yeah. Okay. You still have relatives in New Orleans?
Oh, yes. I am actually lucky to know relatives from my immediate relatives in Louisiana. And because of a cousin's, he did his thesaurus in college on genealogy, tracked our family tree all the way back to 1680 something, I think. And we contact with, and in Chile, my family migrated in the late 1800s from Switzerland to Chile, and then in the early 1900s they migrated to Canada, and then in the early 1900s ended up in the United States, and went with the Cajun migration down into Louisiana, and been eating rice and beans ever since.
Let me ask you why I asked you that.
What's that?
In Netroots Nation this year is New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And Bob might be going down there. Bob?
Hoping to. Cool. Yeah, hoping
okay.
to.
So I was just wondering if you could swing it to go over there. How far is it from you?
It's quite a ways from me. Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's a good, let me see, probably about a 14, 15 hour drive from where I am. I don't stay in much contact with the family I have there because, they are on the other side of the fence.
Yes. Okay. Enough said.
It's pitiful. I haven't heard from a lot of them in a long time.
I get it, Mr. John. That makes me sad, man. I'm on the same page, brother.
Well, it's on both sides of my family, my wife and me. My wife's family, who bless their heart, are the sweetest people you're ever going to want to know. That we just recently saw each other, a lot of us, at a funeral, a family funeral, and it was the first funeral since this all happened, since I started doing what I do, but everybody was gracious to me and treated me real nice, and I was very thankful for that because
they know what you do.
Well, it's not only that; it's a very religious family, and brought out the I've always been an atheist. I just don't buy into the story. It's a wonderful story. There's lots of religions that have that story.
I'm there too.
But on the election day, I made a comment online that I shouldn't have probably made that comment, and certainly should not have made it to the person's timeline, of which I did. He was a preacher, and of which we have several in our family. And
sometimes you're just drawn to it like a moth to a flame.
It came out, and it was a terrible comment. And I was immediately blocked, and that comment was removed from his line. And so this was that funeral was the first time I had seen that family, that part of the family, since then.
Don't beat yourself up, brother. We all step in it from time to time.
Well, I can't change who I am. I can't change my life. Bluntly speaking, I made a bad turn when I was a kid. I was a teenager. I ended up in reform school for a lot longer than what I should have because I tried to escape. And when I say that I have had the Bible beaten into me, I mean exactly that. The man that preached to me on Sunday and beat me with that Bible about a merciful God. Well, God didn't show up on Monday when we hit those fields. And then I saw the hypocrisy of what he was in that place. And so it just changed me forever. And I can't go there. But bless your heart if you do, like we all say down here in, right. down in the South. Bless your little heart.
Bless
your
God love them. Bless their hearts.
That's right. Bless your heart, baby. And I often tell people I am envious sometimes if you have that feeling that you're that comfortable. I believe when I die, it's your worm dirt.
It's just over. It's like going to sleep, you know.
Well,
you're
I
done.
Just think you live on in the memory of those who remember you.
That's right.
That's what you're going to be if important. You're lucky.
John, that's exactly it. I distilled that into a little phrase a long time ago. Memory is eternity.
That's right. As long as they remember you, well, and look at me. Now I've looked back into my history and my family, looked all the way back to 16, whatever it was, and said, wow, look at her. That's that guy's name. And so his memory lives on. And as we further in technology, we'll all know who begot who and who begot who all the way down, I guess. But, it's that little piece of history that you can reach out and hold on to and say, wow.
But it ain't going to hurt. I don't worry about it.
Relating it to nowadays, though, because I often make it a point that my family in Switzerland would probably have no problem at all coming over through customs, coming in and come over to visit. My family in Chile, I'm not sure would have that pleasant of a trip. And that bothers me because the people down in Chile are just wonderful people. I love their barbecues, by the way.
Ooh, I need to hear more about this.
Oh, man.
Chilean barbecue? Do tell.
They split that calf over, put it on that fire, and I mean, it's like a butterfly out there, just roasting it, and just, I'm telling you, these people know how to have fun. I want to go down and guess it. It's just beautiful. Plus, the countryside is just so gorgeous down there in Chile. It really is. But we're a product of a lot of things, all of us are,
sure.
And that's what some of us that understand this immigration issue understand within ourselves is the genealogy coming down the line. We're all immigrants, baby, and especially in this country, as y'all were saying earlier, look what we did to the Native Americans, so we need to shut our mouths sometimes,
Well, that was heinous, heinous.
Well, Sparky mentioned New Orleans, and... that's going to be a few thousand liberals wandering around, and that's part of why I want to get there, just to sort of remind folks that we're here and the conversation's open, and we have a lot of fun. We cuss and carry on and whatnot.
Just like the other side, they just try to hide it more. We don't do.
Well, I think we have more fun because we're not all hung up with the neo-Calvinism and the thou shalt nots and the.
That's we're right. just we gut level honest too. We don't believe in sky spooks, Santa Claus, or the Easter Bunny. I mean, it's that simple,
I'm not walking around with a stick up my butt.
But I do anticipate some, because the other times I've been to that that gathering, there's always a few weirdo wingnuts who show up, and I kind of like the idea of.
Well, that's what we worry about. I'm sure on both sides of the fence, we worry about, that showing up in our party, because we know the other side is full of it.
And it would be fun to see it kind of Louisiana style, with the big banners that say liberals, GEAUXHEAUME.
Go, baby, go.
Liberals, go home.
Go home. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what, I can't get away from that, that taste of New Orleans, because that's where I was raised around a lot. I grew up here in Corpus Christi a lot. I was a Navy brat, born in Guantanamo, Cuba, and floated around, but was basically here between Corpus Christi and New Orleans. And New Orleans, the thing I remember, of course, as a kid was Mardi Gras, baby. For a kid, the feeling of a young kid, we're talking, probably 13 maybe, being in the middle of the French Quarter on Fat Tuesday with the costumes that those people wear, it was heaven, baby. It was pure heaven. And it burned into my soul. And I love the flavor of New Orleans. The spicier the food, the better. And that's why I'm so attracted to Mexican food, for the same reason. But that southern flavor.
Oh, well, see, Appalachian food used to have a little bit of spice and life in it, but it kind of got, got scared away, or the traditions just sort of died out with the older generations. But to get down there, I mean, there's a little hotel that's just around the corner from Mother's. And, of course, Mother's is kind of touristy now, but damn the food. Oh, my God, the food. And, you know, I love the attitude there. I don't drink anymore or anything, but the idea that you can walk right down Canal Street on the sidewalk, slurping away on your beverage of choice, by God.
Yeah, everybody's got a hurricane. Well, every tourist that comes to town has got to have a hurricane. Got to go out to Pat O'Brien's, get your hurricane, go walk out the street.
Pat O'Brien's,
or any of the slushy bars
because they line them. I was just discussing with my kids the other day on Elysian Fields. The first tattoo I ever got in my life was down there in New Orleans, and this is back in the '60s, and tattoo parlors were in very seedy parts of town, and my kids are just learning a lot of stories about their old man.
I have never gotten ink, John, but I finally, because I've been, you know, never saw anything that really appealed to me, and plus I'm a big pain sissy.
I tell people they hurt.
Yeah, but I finally found a phrase in Japanese that I'm thinking very, very seriously about, and I will butcher it if I try to say it, but it's Ichigo Ichie. And I found the characters for it, and basically it's an element of sort of philosophy that says this moment now, never again. In other words, every minute, every second, every instant, every greeting, every gathering, every everything in your life is unique in and of and unto itself, and you need to live like that.
Right. Enjoy it in that moment. I recommended one time to a friend. I was working at the Army Depot out there, and this guy wanted to get his first tattoo, and he was, because I told him I had made mistakes when I was younger. I have I have my name tattooed on me. I had my girlfriend's name tattooed on me next, and the next thing to come was a big black panther over there to cover up the girlfriend's name because I broke up with her, and it goes down that line until I got older. And I had to cover up some ink. I have a massive tattoo on my left shoulder, which is a hawk coming down in attack, which covers up a couple of stupid tattoos. And then my wife's name is on my other arm. But I told this guy, if you're going to get a tattoo, think about it and think about your life and what is the best memory you have from your childhood. Well, he came back to me the next day, and I asked him, I said, did you think about your tattoo, bub? And he said, well, you know, I was thinking about what you said, and I guess the biggest memory from my childhood is this song my mother sang. And I told him, I said, well, there you go. You get that sheet music from that song. And that's what he did. He had that tattoo, that sheet music, tattooed around his arm. So every time he looked down there, he knew what song his mother was singing to him. And it makes that tattoo personal.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
That's what I try to recommend to people. If you're going to get inked up, think of something that's going to really mean something personal to you, and not just a unicorn or a rainbow
in particular, I told my daughters when they were thinking about it, I said, do please remember that you are not always going to be who you are right now.
That's right.
And a tiny balloon can easily become the Hindenburg over time.
Yes. I have
first
one
thing
on
when
my...
I met your son, Bobby, you had to show me his tattoo.
Oh, that tattoo that he got while he was up there. Yeah, you let him out of the house. They're out of sight in the neck. And, you know, I haven't taught him many Latin phrases since then out of fear that they'd wind up. But I told him... I told him about the words of Julius that are attributed to Julius Caesar upon crossing the Rubicon. Alea jacta est, you know, and it's traditionally translated as the die is cast. But linguistically, it really comes across more as let it roll, you know, let it fly, let, you know, and because he also said fortune favors the brave. or fortune, right. Fortune favors the bold. And that had an impact on my son. So he's got Alea Yachta Est on his left, but they put it in the wrong place. I think the guy was a little high or something. And he's got a little pair of dice there, and it says Alea Yachta Est. And
I have one on my left arm that I'm kind of proud of, only because of the fact that there were several of us drunk, and I can't remember how many of us was. We got the same tattoo on the same arm, and it's an anchor, U.S. Navy, just like old Popeye. And but the guy that did it was Lytle Tuttle in a little shop up in San Jose, and then I think that guy went on to become a tattoo artist to the stars or something, but big in the tattoo world.
I never came across any tattoo parlors in Okinawa or Thailand.
Oh, Lord, I did many at the... I didn't get one overseas because one of the places I went to did it the old-fashioned way with the bamboo stick and the needle and the bang, 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 and bullshit. I ain't doing that. Yeah, I can go through a little pain, but no, that's torture.
Life's given me a lot of scars. That's all I need.
Well, I've got plenty of those too.
Oh, there's an episode of one of Anthony Bourdain's series. I think it was back when he did No Reservations before he went to CNN, where he goes and spends time with some tribal people in the South Pacific, and they gave him the real deal. You know.
Yes, I believe I saw that.
The little nail, the wooden block, tack tack tack.
Yep.
That shit has got to hurt.
No. Yes, and they still do that in some traditional places in Japan, and I don't know where else, but in Japan and Southeast Asia, they still tap with the wood, buddy. I'm telling you, I ain't doing that. It's hard enough to go with the electric machine where they're going bzz, 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 and you get around a tender spot. This eagle, this hawk they did on me, right up by my underarm. Where they're feathering out, Lord have mercy. You're going to kill me.
Ouch.
But you can't say nothing because you know everybody's standing right around there. You know, you got to act all right, that badass on my Facebook.
So as a veteran of many tattoos, what is the, understanding that they all hurt like hell,
yes.
What is the least hellish place on your hide to get tattooed?
I would think that your forearm, that's probably why a lot of people get them there. Anything, anywhere where your skin is toughened up a bit, you know, used to it. You get down there, inner thigh, are you kidding me? You kiss my butt. You ain't getting nowhere near me. Under your arms, it's just, these are places.
Soles of the feet are right out.
Yep. Well, yeah, go ahead and do that. I don't know. I've never thought about that. Well, yeah, go ahead and knock yourself out because I got pretty tough feet. It would bother you.
Well, but, that's true. I was thinking about the tender, archy kind of part.
It knocked me out when the price started going up, because nowadays you're paying for artistic work, and in my day, you walked in, there's all sorts of tattoos. I got a tattoo on my right arm. It is now just a blob, but I remember the night I got it. It reminds me all the time, don't be stupid. I was tanked up, pretty well drunk.
That was the next question. For how many of these you three sheets to the wind?
The stupid ones. All drunk.
Seems like this
all drunk.
A Navy thing, dude.
Yeah, the more prettier tattoos I have were done later on in life, and I knew what I wanted and made an appointment.
My best friend in high school went in the Air Force 2 months after me, and his little brother went in the Navy. He got a tattoo on the top of his foot of the Keep On Truckin' Man.
Oh, yes, I remember him. I remember him. Bigfoot out there out front. Keep on trucking, baby. You know.
So every time he goes to the beach, you can look on his foot. If you're staring at his feet, it just says, keep on trucking.
Well, this tattoo on my arm, it was, like I say, drunk. And for I don't know what I was thinking, it's an owl. And it right underneath it, it says, who, me? And it's just, it's dumb. It's stupid. It's who, me? And now it's no longer a brown and all that. It's just a black shape. You can barely tell it's an owl, and you can't read the words anymore. And it's just a big black spot. You know, what happened there? Well, it's a tattoo. Oh, looks like you hurt yourself.
Yeah, my personal favorite, since we touched on religion a little bit ago, John. My personal favorite is the good, God, fair, and upstanding Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, homosexual, who gets only God can judge me tattooed on their flesh, given that there's a commandment against, you know, getting your flesh tattooed.
That's
kind of like I mean, if you believe in that stuff, that's kind of like tweaking God in the nose, isn't it?
Man, thumbing your nose to it. I don't, because I said the other day on one of my rants, I just said that these people that judge, you know, that the baker, I won't bake a cake for you, or anybody at these clinics that protest, or those people are the biggest sinner according to their own book. Because that is a sin to judge other people. And not only is it a sin, according to the Bible, it is a more powerful sin because you do it knowingly, because you have been commanded that that's not your job, buddy. That's God going to judge. You put your two cents in, you are worse than the sinner you're accusing because you do it knowingly. You know, and so I always kind of like throw that at you. You know you're sinning right now, don't you, when you tell me I'm going to hell. You don't know, so
And you know, there's been survey after survey after survey, of course, that demonstrates that people who do not believe actually don't believe because they've spent more time studying what the believers believe than the believers have.
Well, right now, Bob, I'm so proud of my youngest son because of discussions that go on. He decided to start reading the Bible. And I kind of got tickled because we have discussions all the time. And he said, no, Dad, I need to know, because what it was is you saw this YouTube video of the friendly atheist. And he was having a discussion with a guy that ran a YouTube channel. He was a homegrown preacher and was preaching that, according to God's law, gay people should be put to death humanely. Because that's the way he doesn't want the stone throwing thing, you know, because that's not us. But he believes that the government should do it humanely because that's what it calls for in the Bible. Are you shitting me? And the guy that the atheist came back with verse after verse of trapping this guy in his own words, in his own Bible. And my youngest son decided that he wanted to have that knowledge. You know, and I told him, read it, buddy. And if you get saved, good for you. If some, you know, if somebody gets their religion and they feel it in their heart, I'm happy for you. You know, but live that religion the way it's telling you to. And if you do that, well, then you're not sticking your nose ass in somebody else's business. You know. So I don't know. I don't. You know, who am I to judge anybody?
Well, what did George Carlin say? Religion's like a lift in your shoes, and that's fine, but let's don't go nailing lifts on the natives' feet.
That's right. We can't force everybody up. You can't force this stuff down everybody's throat. You know, somebody sent me a T-shirt, 4,200 religion in this world. Which one would you kill for? And I thought that was a very poignant statement, question. Which one would you kill for? I ain't killing for none of them.
Hey, Bob.
Yes, Sparky.
Did you see that video of the people up on the Statue of Liberty today?
Right. Oh, that was a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I was watching that earlier. Yeah, one of them made it all the way up to the feet up there, which my kids just came back from. That's a high place, Dad. Yeah, it is. So, yeah, they're getting
I've been a little tension today.
I've
been there, walked around that damn thing.
I have not. I would love to visit. My kids just went. Just recently, because a friend of theirs lives up in that area, and they were lucky enough to all meet up. It was such a wonderful story in itself. There was, I guess 9 of them that grew up together as little kids. They've all scattered. This one works for the Navy up in New Groton, and an engineer up there, and they all decided, well, they're all going to meet right up there, and they had a wonderful time for about 9 days up in New England, made the trip into the city. And I was so glad that they did have that experience. You know.
Well, get this, John. Back in 2005, I got my first computer, and I was online. I joined this Utapau group.
And oh, really?
It's all. You don't want to go there now, but it's all taken over by chimpanzees.
But anyway, I got in the group and I met
it was a different world back then, Duncan.
I met several liberals from it. It wasn't a waste of time. And I went to a reunion in Dayton, Ohio in 2006.
Wow. That's cool. That is really neat. I'd love to make a trip back over some of the places I've been, but I know they're not the same places I left. You know.
Well, I lost my train of thought there.
Yeah, well, jump on that bandwagon. I've been there lately a lot.
You got to excuse me. I've been vaping some good bud.
No, don't be bragging here.
Perish the thought.
Well,
yeah.
Everybody already knows I've been to the pot store several weeks ago.
Oh. Listen to that shit.
Yeah, I know.
They ought to lock you up. I'm
John, this...
come by and take all your shit, too.
Yeah, John, this happens all the time. You know, those West Coasters, they know how it is back here behind the corn pone curtain. They know that we can go to prison for life for a goddamn two stems and a seed.
We
get stories about going to the store.
I know it. It's killing me with this. I picked out some Blue Moon. Are you shitting me? Your shit's got names? What do you got?
Yeah.
I got one name.
White Widow.
I was
doing some Blue Dream here a while ago.
Well, I understand that is a very nice stream from
I've heard. The thing is, stuff shows up around here, and they're, oh man, this is like bubble. This is like, parsnip kumquat kush. And you're like, how do I fucking know? I'm, because I just believe you. Oh yeah, man. It would be fun. It would be fun. And, you know, God only knows in a state the size of Texas, John, or here in the middle Atlantic states where we're within a 4-hour drive of a bajillion people. You go legal, everything changes. But we're
well, that's
but
what
both
they keep
states,
telling me, Bob.
Yeah, but both states are in the death grip of people who, you know, think that maybe people should just keep suffering, you know, because Jesus did.
Well, suffering is not a problem then. I'll tell you why down here in Texas, we're going to be the last ones for one big reason. Look at the size of our border. Out of the drug war money, I would say that we get a pretty good sized chunk of that money because we got lots of border to protect. And it's a money making deal. You know, we get a lot of funds from the federal government for that work. And Jesus, it's a jobs program, you know, keep everybody employed. But I always remind everybody, you know, if you took a section of land and say you built a wall around it and surrounded that wall with barbed wire and guard towers to keep drugs out of that spot, you can't do it. We call that prison. You can buy the same shit out in prison as you can buy out on the street.
And maybe
because
better.
It's because somebody's going to bring it in. You're not going to keep it out of a prison. If you can't keep it out of a walled prison, what kind of crazy idea is that you could think that you could keep it out of the country?
Well,
can grow in his backyard.
In a place like West Virginia that's eat up with opioids, the data out there that suggests your opioid problem goes down when you legalize cannabis, you know, but we're well past common sense. Because this is a state that still has billboards in it, John, that say coal. Clean, carbon neutral coal.
And that's an outright lie. You're just not going to do it. There's no such animal. But that's not the point. All you have to do is sell that bumper sticker. Because on the right, like I always say, it doesn't take a lot of intelligence on their side. They just have to come up with the right bumper sticker, the right slogan. You know, military, I support the troops, baby.
Right
you see
to
it all
life.
Over the place.
Right to life.
That's right. I pray and I vote. You know, it's just short sentences.
Right, yeah, because right to life sounds so much better than fetus fetishist.
Yes, fetus killers, baby monsters that, you know, they rip them up and they go into such descriptive language. I swear they really get a joke, a rise out of it. They just love to do that. Because I got into a discussion one time with a family member about the issues, and Obama was president, and that was a sin upon itself. But issue after issue, we didn't argue, we discussed, until we had her back down into one central issue. Well, you know, I'm in it, John, for the babies. Oh, Lord. There's the argument I can't win. I can't fight against your religion, your God. You know, you whip that out and you use it as an armor, as a last resort to prove that you're in this for the holiest of reasons, for the purest of reasons. When, as your Bible teaches, it's none of your damn business. Leave the woman alone. That's up to her.
Well, right. That's the fundamental flaw in the so-called pro-life argument, is that none of them can make it, none of them can ever get past the fact that when they make the argument, they are arguing for imposing their religion on people who may not necessarily share it.
That's it. You know, you all was talking about founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, his famous quote, the separation between church and state is essential to a free democracy. He said essential. And that's the part I don't want you to, you know, the law is based on Judeo-Christian. You know, thou shalt not kill. It's chiseled in stone, John. It was a 10th. Yeah, because we all know common sense. That I don't. You don't.
Right,
you,
and because
you need a God to tell you not to kill your fellow man.
And because every
you have a problem.
And because every developed culture on Earth has developed that same rule, and most of them,
yes,
without the benefit of good old bearded juvenile delinquent Bronze Age Yahweh, Jehovah, Allah, God in the sky.
No, so nobody walked up the mountain and came down with stones and said, hey, look, this is what the guy said. It's inherent. That's what they were talking about when y'all were talking about inalienable rights. I'm going to catch my thought there. In the Declaration of Independence there in the beginning. Certain inalienable rights endowed by their creator.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Bob. I just had a sparky. I had a thought in my head. And
no,
all of a sudden,
you know what?
You're not even high.
I'm not, buddy. Ain't that the shit?
Yeah, and I got Larry rubbing it in over here, too. I just bought some Blue Dream today here in Oregon. Go, Sparky.
All right.
You fuckers.
Are you shitting me?
Well, can I jump in here for just a second?
Jump, Steve, jump.
Jump, Steve. This is the part that always pisses me off, or just flabbergasts me, with these holy rollers. And I'm sure you've all heard this before. They love the fetus, but they don't have any problem later, 18 years later, taking that same fetus and sending it to a meat grinder in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Well, hell, they're perfectly content.
That's different. That's
and well,
different.
But yeah, but look, they're perfect. They're perfectly content kidnapping former fetuses.
Yeah, that's no problem, buddy. And putting them in cages. You know what?
Good God, we're in a hell of a mess.
Of religion in itself, you can twist that shit into so many different. You know, origami has nothing on how many ways you can twist it. As we all know, any subject matter you want to take up, any issue you want to either be pro for or against, you can go to that Bible. You can look up a verse that will support either your anti position or your pro position. It doesn't matter. You can find a verse in there that's going to back you up, and that's what's so it's ridiculous. I always try to remind people the most important word on your Bible is the one up front that says version. There you go.
Yep.
The only people I'll ever be indebted to, religious people, is the Mennonites. When they came to help out, when we got flash flooded, it was like, we don't want nothing. We just want to help you. Okay, I need the carpet ripped out of my house. We can do that.
We can do that, brother.
I'll tell you what.
They came in with a 7-man crew and ripped all the carpeting out of my house.
Oh, cool.
So now I got hardwood floors.
There you go.
That my sisters and I never knew even knew were there.
Yeah, I bet they're a lot prettier than that old carpet, too.
Well, we like them now, but we should have done more to upgrade.
Let's see. Kirk,
I look at it this way. I'm not going to invest the money in it when I got to put a new roof on.
Well, I have to get ready for a flood every few years. I live right on the river. We flood every once in a while.
Which river is that, John?
It's the Nueces River. It runs pretty much out from out near southern West Texas all the way to the Gulf down here. And the difference being, I tell people, is I live, there's a dam upriver from me. It forms Lake Corpus Christi. The river flows into that lake, and anything above that lake, when you get out to a little bit west of West Texas there, the water is crystal clear. Rock bottom, you can see it. It's just so gorgeous. Well, I live on the other side of the dam before it hits the Gulf of Mexico, and it's the muddy river. You know, you can't see the bottom of this river, but that dam is old. It's part of the failing infrastructure they have. So when it rains profusely, they have to open the gates to release the pressure on the dam. And when they do, the only way in and out of my house is by boat. So the hardest thing I'd have to do, though, is pick up stuff, make, you know, my house is on stilts, you know, but my shop isn't, and I have to put everything above the water line, and I have to get my livestock out. So those are the key issues. But other than that, I tell people when it's not flooding, I can sit down there in the river and fish all day, baby. So
what's good in the river fish wise?
Catfish, white bass. We got a lot of alligator gar down here. I got about a 7-footer on my line about 2 summers ago. Biggest fight I ever had on a line in my life. That thing was just a monster. And then just the other day, it was in the news, they pulled a 12-foot alligator out. When I go kayaking, you know, I keep my eyes open. We were kayaking one day up the river, and my kid, Dad, come see this. Look at this. I paddle over there. What's up? Look, baby alligators. Oh, shit. Back up.
Yeah, get away. If there's a baby alligator, there's a mama alligator.
There's a mama. That's the part right. They didn't understand. They was paddling over there to go look. Are you shitting me? Get the hell out of there.
And mama is very protective, too.
Yes, they are. So that's a lesson they learned real quick. I had goosebumps going all over my arms. All I could see was one of them kicking up and knocking my kid's kayak over or some shit. And mama killing me. The whole story played out in my head in a matter of minutes. So,
yeah, and whilst you were paddling.
Yes, while I was back paddling. The whole scenario.
Bob,
he was
Mr.
putting
John,
me through a wood chipper right at the end of the...
I need to jump in here real quick just to say good night. The fireworks are going off. My little dog is freaking out.
Oh, poor little Cletus.
She needs your dad, man. So I got to go, man. As much as I'd love to stay
here.
Hey,
Steve, thanks for chipping in this evening, my friend. Thank you so very much. Thank
no
little
worries.
Cletus for me.
When
things run dry like they've been for the last couple of days, that's a big help. I appreciate it. We all do.
Hey, and Steve?
Yes, sir, Mr. Duncan.
Don't worry about that package you're sending me.
It's coming your way.
I'll be excited when I get it. I don't know what the hell it is, but he's got some kind of thing for the man cave.
Yep. I want some.
You're
going to
love it. You're going to love it. I already know, and you can't get it out of me.
Yep. All right. Well, I love you guys. Okay. And thanks so much for letting me be a part of this.
Oh, you take care, Steve.
Take care of yourself.
Happy Independence Day. And tell little Cletus it's going to be all right.
All right. Y'all take care now.
Later now.
Bye.
I can relate. I got fireworks going off here, and I have a donkey outside that is just not going to like this at all. She never does. Yeah, she's my baby. That's what I tell. I'm so liberal, I have a donkey. What do you want to know?
There we go.
Well, the herd just came into view out the north door here.
See there, we all got a little piece of heaven we ought to be thankful for.
Well, you know, I was gonna.
We call them the moving lawnmowers.
Yeah.
I was gonna tell you a minute ago. There's a little moment of irony there. You live not far from the banks of the Nueces River. I live not far from the banks of the New River. So,
there you go.
But the new
river.
Well,
you know what Nueces means.
What?
And mind you, I live in Nueces County. That's the name of my county is Nueces County, and the river is the Nueces River. And Nueces is the Indian word for nuts. So, we're all nuts down here. Bob.
Well,
you can't beat me. I live in the land of fruits and nuts.
That's what I've heard. That's what I've heard. But I don't believe that story. I lived out there, buddy.
Well, the funniest part about the New River is it's the second oldest river on Earth.
Second oldest river on Earth. But it's the New River.
Yep, right. Yep.
I traveled up there, went through Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, into that area up there. And I'm telling you, the scenery is gorgeous. It's just, like they say, to die for. It's just really, really beautiful, lush, and just, I was so impressed traveling up in there.
Well, I tell you what, if you enjoy your kayaking, John, you need to come up here and do some up here.
I'm telling you, I love my kayak. You
know, depending on how bold you feel about your kayaking.
Oh, got a little white river, do you?
The new river is plenty white water. And then and then come about August when they open the spillways on the Summersville Dam, the Gauley River turns into the premier class 5 whitewater river in east.
No. I paddle up river, Bob, until my arms get tired, I guess. And no houses, no nothing up there. And then I just stop, put the oar down, and let the current bring me back. And it's a very slow, meandering current. And, I don't know, maybe half hour or so, I might find myself back at my house.
Well, there's some beautiful flat water on the New River as well. If you ever get a hankering to see some different countryside along the riverbanks.
Oh, we did. When I retired from the Army in 2001, I took my family in an RV and we traveled around the country. One of my favorite places would like to go back to, I found up in Arkansas. It was called the White River up by Bull Shoals. And I guess living in salt water all my life, you know, on the coast and the ocean and whatnot, I went there and look, there are big trout. I mean, huge trout. And you can see them through that. Look at there. They're right there. And I went down to the dock at the state dock at this park, the state park I was in. And I walked in and I'm looking behind the counter and there are all these little cans of corn. What's up with the corn? Well, that's the bait. That's the bait. Whole kernel corn. And they were pulling trout out of there like you wouldn't believe. But the water was so crystal clear, cold, coming out of a dam.
Oh, that sounds mighty fun. That sounds mighty fun.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had to mute the mic. I had to cough, and I didn't want you to.
Oh, I appreciate that.
That's, you got me a set of my teeth.
I had my favorite brand of grape soda imported to me up here by my sister and brother-in-law a couple of weeks ago. So I've been enjoying one of those. Can't get it up here. It's out of a little bottling outfit in Birmingham. What's the name of it? Buffalo Rock bottling, and it's called Grapeico, Grapico. No grape soda out there like it. And it comes in a diet variety, and it doesn't taste diet. So I'm down to my last 12 pack.
One of the little perks here that, you know, since I started doing this, that my show, I just call it a rant. I hate to call it a show because I'm not trying to put on a show. I'm just trying to get my shit out of my head. But when I started to grow a following, and I got tickled to death. We just went over 10,500. So I'm getting all itchy. Look at there we go. But the benefit, one of the really side benefits to that is when you get some fans that want to send you something and they send it to you, and I have had some of the best candies in the world sent to me, some of the best jellies, food items that just from Scotland, from England, from all across the United States and whatnot. It could be as simple as beef jerky. The last package I got had a little package of beef jerky from this special place up in Massachusetts, and it was the first thing to go out of the package. We all sliced it up in the family here, and everybody got a little taste of it. It was great. But, you know, getting those little items from far away
it's an absolute blast.
It's a joy.
Let me suggest to you, though, John, you have not lived until you've got a can of deliberately rotten fish from Sweden.
Oh, is that? No, I haven't got that yet.
Oh, my no. Jesus. Our buddy Scott, who lives over there, he's a Swede now. informed me in the Horn Family Community Congregation about a Swedish phenomenon. You know, the Norwegians have lutefisk, which is fish that's been preserved in lye.
Oh, which is delicious.
Delicious with sweet taters, you know? but the Swedes, not to be outdone, came up with something called surströmming. And this stuff came with instructions, John. Do not open inside your house.
Oh, no.
And I mean...
You gotta go outside?
Oh, Agnes and I walked down into the back half of the acre to open it. And I swear, I think it chased us back into the house. But by God, we ate it. We ate it.
There you go.
You had the weed eating done, I guess.
This was back when we actually had a working riding lawnmower.
Oh, man.
Oh.
There are challenges in life. That would be one of them.
Oh, it was real. It was real.
Duncan, have you ever heard of a balut?
Yeah, but I don't know what it is.
It's an egg that halfway through fertilization is stuck in the ground and let it rot for a long time. And when you're in the Philippines, well, that it's a delicacy over there. They just you crack that thing open and it's a little chicken in there. Sort of almost formed, and it's just gross and it stinks. But they come down the street yelling, balut, balut. They'll have a whole cart on them. And for a sailor, you know, it's a challenge. You come there, you got to try to eat one.
I only spent two nights in the Philippines.
Oh.
I didn't get off Clark Air Force Base.
Oh, Lord. No, I was stationed there for about 6 months. I re-enlisted in the
And let me guess, the little bones are kind of like the bones in a sardine. You can chew them right up.
I don't know, Bob. I never got one down. I got one in my mouth, and that's as far as it went. So, but Tui, give me a beer. I don't know. No. But I've seen a lot of drunk sailors try to eat one, and I more power to them. But if you can keep that thing down. But if you go, it's still to this day a delicacy over there, a balut.
That or an inside joke on American sailors, I mean.
Yeah, eat this. Look at that, he really ate it. Yeah, that's a drunk sailor.
I missed my freedom bird to go to Thailand, so I had to come back. And I flew on a C-5 all the way to the Philippines. Then I had to hitch on a 141 that landed in Bangkok.
Oh, Bangkok.
That's a military terminal in Bangkok. I get off the plane. I'm sitting in the military terminal, and this black guy comes up to me, and he goes, you want to get high? Sure. He said, follow me. Let's go across the street to Mama San's. And that was my experience arriving at Thailand, because I had to wait for a C-130 to go to Utapau out of Bangkok. So we went across the street to Mama San's and got loaded and then came back and waited for our plane. But
I remember Thailand was the only place I was that from the barracks, Mama San would bring you, you know, whatever you needed, whatever you wanted. I smoked a pot, so you could just order it up. She'd bring it right to the barracks.
Did you ever go to Grunt's Grove?
Grunt's Grove. Duncan, my time, was a typical sailor. There was a lot of places I went that I ended up drunk.
TDY to there?
Yes. Yeah. I bounced between Utapau, back to the Philippines, and let me see. We had a detachment in Diego Garcia. Wonderful Diego Garcia, where people go to die. And, you know, I went up to Taiwan. You know, I bounced all around the South Pacific to Guam, Midway. So, I tell people I wouldn't trade the first 4 years that I did for anything in the world.
I spent 3 months on the Rock, TDY.
Well, hey, I spent my time in Adak, Alaska. It don't get no worse than that. There is no town on Adak.
Guess what? My dad was in Adak, Alaska during the war.
Oh, Lord. They had a fence around one tree. That's the Adak National Forest right there. Our greatest joy was tundra country.
Well, you know my dad's saying?
Huh.
There was a woman behind every tree in ADAC.
That's right, baby. There was. There was.
There ain't no trees.
And they got a fence around the only one up there. That was the coldest, most miserable place I've been. Just to get an aircraft off the deck was a laborious chore to do. And when it came back, it was just as bad. Everything we had to be flown in. When a plane landed coming from California, baby, that Bombay was filled up with Coors beer or Olympia. One of the two. It was the Bombay was all that was all it was. Beer.
Yeah.
So that's how we got it up there.
We had a beer vending machine in Okinawa.
Yes, I remember those.
Only dispensed Budweiser. It was 25 cents a beer.
I was in Naha.
So anyway, while I was stationed at Kadena with the SR-71.
Wow.
So anyway.
Spies, huh?
Boom operators who would smuggle cases of Coors beer over on the KC-135s when they came.
American beer was very popular if you could get it.
Well, they smuggled Coors beers in from the States, boom operators, and then I was lucky enough to get a six-pack of it through some connections I had. But even when the beer was gone, I'd go down and buy a Budweiser from the vending machine, put it in the Coors beer can, and walk down to the day room just to piss everybody off.
Where'd you get that? I ain't telling.
Well, you know this such a so-and-so, you know any boom operators? They're bringing it over. And the guy goes, no, I don't know any boom operators. Well, I can't help you out. I've sworn to secrecy.
Yeah. Every time one of our planes landed, everybody knew that there was in that Bombay was all stuffed with all shit from home. So a good time would be had by all when them planes landed.
Well, speaking of things military, just so that we can go out on a light note, gentlemen. I don't know if y'all saw this earlier today, but you might recall that Julius Geezer has declared that it was really stupid to go into Iraq. Very stupid. I was against
very
it.
Very stupid.
Of course, you know, there's tweets to show otherwise. There always are.
Yes. Of course.
But there is cause for a little bit of alarm because apparently Julius Geezer has had, granted it's a very, very teeny tiny one, but he's had a hard-on to start a war in Venezuela.
I spoke about that today. Isn't that nice to know? He was just in office. Now, he made that inquiry last year right after. You know, he took office.
Right, and remember,
the first thing you're going to do is try to come in here and get in a war with Venezuela.
And remember how they told him when he called his boss, I mean his friend, Pootie.
Yeah.
They wrote across the top of the paper, "Do not congratulate." And the first thing he said was, "Well, I just wanted to congratulate you on your brilliant electoral victory. You got more votes than Hillary."
Mm-mm-mm. Are you shitting me? Now you understand that when he goes over to meet Pootie this time, he wants to meet alone with nobody else in the room. I guess that's so they can get in there and laugh their ass off.
Well, no, he can get in there and get more instructions.
Yeah, it's the ring or whatever it is, because you know it. That's the way it is.
Well,
who the power is in that relationship.
Oh, without a doubt. Well, the reason I mention that is because when he went to a meeting of the UN General Assembly, he was also told, because he'd been asking, well, why can't we just invade Venezuela? That's what we should do. And so he went to the UN General Assembly, and he was told, listen, don't ask the Colombians or the Brazilians or the Ecuadorians or the Peruvians or the Chileans or the Argentinians. Don't ask them or the Bolivians about invading Venezuela. Just don't do it, okay? So immediately, the first thing he does when he sits down with all those folks is he says, my staff has told me not to ask you, but don't you think it'd be a good idea to invade Venezuela?
Are we just I'm telling you. You know, if he kisses in a war someplace, he just thinks he'd have an easier time staying in power.
Well, what scares the shit out of me is the fact that he's president of the United States. And so...
That in itself.
I mean, right. I mean, yeah, tell us something we don't know, Bob. Stop telling us how to be scared, Bob. But no, the fact of the matter is, if it comes right down to it, the way everything's structured, if he wants to invade Venezuela, the only thing the brass in the Pentagon can do is fucking salute and say, yes, sir.
Yes, yes, yes. He is the commander in chief. And isn't that just, that's a scary thought.
Well, I mean, that'll get, I mean, if you take a minute with that, that'll give you the dribbling turtle squirts.
Yes, yes, yes. And we're not that safe. You know, you go, well, we wouldn't be, we'd be at a nuclear war with North Korea if it wasn't for me. That wasn't that comment he made the other day. We're not out of the woods here because with this news that Korea is modifying some of their bases and continuing on with their program, as we all knew they would, well, that's going to put Donnie in a little bind there because he's done come home saying that it's a done deal. And we all know he is not about to give up his nuclear weapons.
No. And now we've got definitive proof that he isn't.
Yeah.
And so
that puts Donnie in the little box of going back to calling him Little Rocket Man or some shit like that. Because he is not above starting a war, I believe, anywhere. Because of the Wartime Powers Act, and you know, he thinks he can use something like that to stay in power forever.
Exactly.
Look how long we've been in Afghanistan.
If shit goes sideways, more than it already is.
And if he stacks the Supreme Court, and you know, that's how we change the Constitution, through the Supreme Court.
There we go.
That's how that happens. I joke because my wife was watching that The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you get to that? Well, first you stack the Supreme Court. You know, that's how you get there.
And then you get total, complete, and unquestioning control of the military.
Yes, yes. It's a scary thought.
Get rid of Posse Comitatus.
Now, these are the things that writers make up stories about to try to make them sound plausible. And now we're in a situation to where they are plausible. It is. It's just too damn scary. We just keep reminding that, you know, just like you say, I'm a cheerleader. I want people to get out and vote. I encourage them because it's our voice and our vote is the only thing we have left. And if we don't use those, you know, profusely, we will lose those powers.
Well, so, you know, it's like, I have this nasty habit, John, that I've told everybody else about. My wife and I wake up in the morning and we turn on that little program on MSNBC. You know, the liberal network that gives its three prime time hours to a right winger.
Fake news.
We refer to it as morning conniption because you wake up and you try, you can't wait to see what's giving Mika a conniption. But I saw
you probably have a Jones on it if you don't watch it.
No, not really. No, we get through the day just fine. We have been known to miss it. But I woke up this morning and there was this little, and he's on there a lot, this little neo-maxi Zoom dweeby by the name of Noah Rothman. And he's apparently some sort of a right winger. And he was there saying, well, you know, these members of the left, they overreact. There they are marching in the streets against fascism, and that proves there's no fascism.
You watch some of these. My wife, you know, she'll see one of these live videos going on, a protest or something in that, and she'll say, "Honey, look at this," and we'll be sitting there watching. And then she'll start reading some of the comments that come across from these right wing nut jobs that are just. You know, if there's a protest, what are these people? None of them have a job. I bet they all live in the street. George Soros owes me a lot of money, evidently. I didn't get no check. Evidently, everybody else is getting checks from George Soros.
It ain't just you. I've been going down to the post office every day. No, it ain't here yet, Bob.
I'm fixing to drive to his house and just listen here, buddy. If everybody's getting checks, you owe me.
I want my big old early Kyler George Soros money check.
Newsflash, you guys.
And they believe that shit. That's the sad thing, really. You know, my own brother once made a comment to me, and
he said, well, the first thing that happened when Obama got president was he gave all the blacks $10,000.
What? That was my brother. I hate to say that. chances are he's not going to be listening to this show, believe
yeah,
me.
Yeah, that's what the tequila bottle and the swirly straw is for.
He was serious. Now, I had to explain to him the amount of money that he was talking about and where did they get that. And don't you think somebody in the Treasury or somebody in the Department of Money might have noticed that all this cash was flowing out? But you didn't see that. And well, that's what I heard. Jeez, and whatever it is you're listening to, stop that bullshit, because it just, but that's how Fox News stays in business.
And just one more little thing to ponder as we head out the door here. Maybe you've already seen this too, John, but it's new to me. We all had a connection. That's a handy little word. When Justice Kennedy all of a sudden announced that he was just tired of being a Supreme Court justice and he was ready to go and live on a farm somewhere and play with all the other little retired justices.
Yeah, the check cleared the bank.
Well, something interesting has turned up. Apparently, he was not planning on resigning.
Hmm.
Because would
motivate him?
He had already selected all of his law clerks for the next term.
I believe I started to read that story or read the headline or caught a whiff of that.
You don't do that if you're about to quit.
That's right. Why would you do that?
Well, maybe if you got wind that Bob Mueller had already found out about the billion-dollar loan to Donnie Dipshit that his boy made.
You better get somebody on that court that's going to give that's going to judge your case when he goes in front of it. That's what. It's so sickening that when you start to get into that story of Deutsche Bank and the money and all that stuff, how can you not sit out here as an intelligent being with a mind that works and not think, hey, wait a minute.
Well, and here's where it gets better. If he'd stayed on the court and his boy got ensnared in the Deutsche Bank probe via Mueller and got charged with a crime,
and
it made it to the Supreme Court, then he couldn't have avoided recusing himself.
He would have to recuse himself.
And that would have left a split court, which meant that if the appeal was of a conviction, the conviction would stand.
Yeah. So now we're going to have to sit back and watch how this plays out.
Well, if they get their way now, they'll have a reliable justice on there to vote to overturn any conviction. Yes. Of poor little Tony's poor little son.
You throw that in with Donnie's power to pardon, and what a hell of a recipe for a cake that is, ain't it?
It's a
shit pie.
it's a shit cake with a syphilis center. It is.
Yep.
Well, John, I want to thank you for wandering by and remind everybody that they can find you on Facebook. Over at Blue Dot.
And, yes, sir. Wait.
Go right ahead.
You can find me on YouTube at a Blue Dot in Texas or on Facebook under John Brittabeau or our fan page, John Brittabeau Speaks Blue Dot Family. Out my truck window anywhere I can get the news out, Bob.
I just scream
a lot,
Well, when the power went out halfway through the program on Monday, I just spent the rest of the time standing on the back stoop and hollering, so...
There you go. I got to let this shit out. And I'm lucky enough to have people that want to listen to me, and I'm, I count my lucky stars for that.
Well, I enjoy the heck out of our conversations, both of them so far, and you're welcome most any time, John.
I want you to know I really enjoy it. I really appreciate you really delaying my video getting put up today.
It's on me, man.
Which is totally Bob's fault now, but I was thoroughly engrossed in the conversation that was going on with Dr. Bill. And I really enjoyed that, and I really get it.
If you've got a couple of minutes laying around between, that would be noon and 2 your time, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, check him out. He's always that good.
I'm telling you, I was really engrossed by his knowledge and his interpretation of everything that he was talking about. I thought it was a look here, a History Channel. It's a documentary, and I don't even have to turn the channel. But I really did. I enjoyed that.
Well, I
try to learn something every day, Bob. when I quit doing that, well,
exactly, okay. Exactly. Well, thank you, John. Thank you very kindly. And thank you, Sparky, for moderating as ever. And I guess it's time we should be getting out of here. In fact, a little past time. Again, thanks to Steve for jumping in. And thanks to our new subscriber, Thomas, and thanks to Kelly for subscribing. So the fundraising goal went down to 340, and by tomorrow evening we'll be at 540, and we'll just kind of cross our fingers along the way. Thanks to everybody who keeps all of this going. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Steve from Georgia Stan, now tending to Cletus under the bed there with the fireworks going off. Poor little Cletus. Thanks to Sparky for his moderating duties. Thank you very kindly to our news ninjas. Thank you. Thank you very kindly to Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. And thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Go over to CRMW's Coal River Mountain Watch's Facebook page. There's some new drone footage out that just starts out hovering above the Judy Bond Center and then goes up through the clouds, and it's some of the most amazing drone footage you're ever likely to see. It's just stunning. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Happy Independence Day, everybody. Later.